In the air to right center field. Well hit. Hat goes back to the wall. And that ball is gone! Michael A. Taylor. With a grand slam home run in the eighth off Wade Davis.
I'm all in. I'm a Cubs fan. I'm a Cubs fan. Yeah, I'm
it's 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. It is time for True Blue Playoff Plus. The Chicago Cubs lose game four at Wrigley Field, 5-0 to the Washington Nationals, forcing a game five as many predicted. Andy Mazur, Mark Carmen in studio right now. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. Guys, let's go right to the takeaways of this game as we break down what we saw, a sloppy game on the field, both the weather and the Cubs.
Painful is one word. That hurts. You don't score. Can't win a game when you don't score. John Lester was great. Jake Arrieta wasn't. C.J. Edwards wasn't. And the offense was not there. The best thing I could say about what's going on from my perspective is if you are going to a Game 5 on the road, at least you don't have to face Steven Strasburg again. So,
unbelievable performance. 12 strikeouts tonight. Mm-hmm. Becomes, in franchise history, the Nationals' most strikeouts. But I mean, just with the Cubs, 22 Ks in two games.
Yeah, I mean, he's a strikeout pitcher, and this is a very aggressive hitting team, and they do tend to strike out a bit. There's guys in that order that will work a pitch, or work a pitcher, like Anthony Rizzo had a 12-pitch at bat late in that game and wound up grounding out. Tough to win, though, when Chris Bryant goes 0-for-4 with 4 Ks, not to single him out, but, you know, Addison Russell kind of set the tone in a bad way early with that error after Jake Arrieta pitched around a horrible call at first base by Jerry Lane. But you got to make that play. No excuses there. You got to make the play. Because if Zimmerman hits that ball, it's a triple.
Yeah,
it was the worst check swing call I've ever seen.
I mean, I was at the park and all the people around are screaming about the first base umpire, and that's fine.
But you got to make the play.
You got to make the play.
You got to pitch around that stuff, you know. And Jake Arrieta made a good pitch and basically was out of the inning, and Russell couldn't make the catch. And you know, again, as Mark said, you can't win if you don't score.
Right.
I mean, there were some good things. I mean, I thought that Arrieta battled. He gave you four. I don't know if he was going to be able to give you four, especially with the hamstring situation. And his control, you could tell, was off from pretty much jump. But, you know, you got a guy like Lester that wants to come in there. Unlike the starter for the Nationals today, amazing, they had to be talked into it and shamed into it. unfortunately for the Cubs, he actually pitched.
What a goofy beginning of the day today is press conferences and switcheroos from what they were talking about last night with Steven Strasburg. But back to the Cubs, John Lester comes through as he does all the time. Now the question is going to be, he runs into maybe a blip in the sense that Daniel Murphy gets on base after he electrified the crowd with a pickoff move.
Mm-hmm. That was huge.
That's huge. Awesome. But the play after that, Joe Maddon goes to his bullpen. Questionable call?
I didn't like it. John was dealing. He had, at that point, he had given up. That was the one hit that he had given up. And yeah, he had walked Zimmerman before that. But I would have let him finish the inning. This is your horse. This is your best guy. This is your money guy. And Carl Edwards Jr. has had his struggles. Mm-hmm. So, listen, he tends to make these moves that, by the book, they make sense. And that card that he holds seems to indicate what to do, but sometimes it just doesn't feel right.
Andy, let me ask you this too, because that was strange in baseball, because if you're a baseball fan, you understand, but the idea of a 1-0 count, taking a pitcher out at that point, not traditional, because there's a lot of flow, things of that nature. To bring a closer in at that moment when he's already in a 1-0 count, that is somewhat perplexing.
It's a difficult thing to kind of comprehend, but I think Joe just decided, hey, listen, at this point, this kid doesn't have it. I can't let this go to 0-2. I can't let him throw a fastball down the middle and get beat here. Let me go to my veteran guy who you would think can put out of his mind to the 1-0 count and usually a strike thrower. Hadn't given up a lot of home runs, hadn't blown any saves in the regular – had one blown save in the regular season. But this is, you know, the kind of the argument that we kind of saw last year, especially with Aroldis Chapman making as many pitches as he did during the playoff run last year. And, it worked out well. It was not conventional by any stretch of the imagination. But there are certain guys that have that mindset that they're coming in to save a game. They're not coming in to keep the lead 1-0. It was a terrible pitch.
Let's go to the on the podium.
Thinking about it in the first place, I thought CJ was going to should be able to get that one out. At that point, I'm looking at there's potentially a tie the game, and you might need Wade for two innings. So Once it got to the point where it looked like CJ was missing the plate a lot, we got him ready. We'd not have put him in the game had he not said that he was ready. The phone rang. He said he was ready. We put him in the game.
Phil, left.
Yes, Joe, just kind of your general thoughts going forward for a deciding game five, and also the thought this was a very close series tonight, 5-0, but a ball that goes into the basket by a little bit and the Russell error that allows another run.
Yeah, but give that, I mean, Taylor, I mean, that ball had to be absolutely crushed. That's into a gale, high, opposite field. All those factors are involved. Give him, I mean, that surprised all of us, obviously. Once, you know, CJ's having a hard time, I thought, you know, Wade can get out of this like I thought, and then four outs, and then we'll see what happens. But give Taylor credit, man, because you have to scald that ball to get it out, Oppo. We just have to do a better job offensively, too. We've scored limited runs. Their guy was outstanding tonight, like we talked about beforehand. Strasburg was that good. The changeup was spectacular. We did not had to hit that one ball good to left field earlier that the wind knocked down. Otherwise, we didn't really have a good time against them.
On the right, Dan?
Yes, sir.
Joe, you just kind of touched on this, but Strasburg from the dugout, outside of maybe the changeup, or maybe just build on that, what stood out to you about his outing?
Gets ahead in the count. You know, fastball command is outstanding. He's really able to throw his fastball for a strike when he wants to, where he wants to. His curve was really good, too. He had everything going on tonight. So if you don't get him early in the count, it's really difficult because he has these two other outstanding pitches to throw deeper in the count, curveball, changeup, which he did. You know, the last time we played him, we tried to jump him early, but we didn't have a lot of success in Washington either. He's pitching absolutely at the top of his game right now. That is really good stuff. Give him credit.
Far right.
Yes, sir.
What did you think of Jake?
You know, Jake, physically fine. Command off a little bit. Battled through that. I mean, it was 90 pitches after four, and I thought, how about Johnny Lester tonight? Johnny Lester gave us a chance to win that game. But I thought, overall, Jake, stuff-wise, not bad, but not as sharp as he can be.
Dave in the middle.
Yes. So, Joe, what's the mindset and plan for tomorrow with your pitching staff?
Well, you got, obviously, starting Kyle, and then Quintana will be play the role of Johnny Lester tomorrow if it's necessary. So we talked about that pregame. If, in fact, it was really close, which it was. That was a good spot for Lester tonight. And then tomorrow, just everybody's available tomorrow. So it'll start with Kyle. And Q's ready tomorrow to back up like Johnny did tonight. And then the entire bullpen will be fine tomorrow.
Back right.
Yes, sir.
Last time you were in a position was a game seven. What's the message and mindset to the team heading into this winner take all?
Honestly, I don't say a whole lot. Actually, I don't say anything. I just want them to go and prepare like we normally do. Like I said, we just have to be offensively a little bit better tomorrow. They've been really good. We've been really good. So listen, they got a grand slam. I mean, otherwise, that was kind of like the same game both sides. We walked a couple guys, which really hurt to set the whole thing up. But neither side really killed the ball tonight. They punctured the win. We didn't, and they got the win. But that's pretty much been the entire series. Both pitching staffs have done a great job.
In front of you, Mark.
Yes, sir.
So what made you decide to go with Lester tonight, and what did you think of the pickoff?
Well, you know, the fact that he was available, you know, we could have done him or Quintana, but he pitched before Q, so we went with him first. Knowing that we didn't know exactly where Jake was going to be tonight, so we talked about that in advance. And now when that showed up, if this score was like we're losing 4-0, he would not have pitched tonight. It would have been Montgomery and the rest of the bullpen. But 1-0 at that part of the game, I felt pretty strongly about it. And so it was that. It was the fact predetermined that he's going to back up Jake tonight, and then Q would back up Kyle tomorrow night because we were able to do that. So that was it.
Phil?
Hey, yes. Joe, on your hitters and the lack of scoring, what would you point to for the big issues and any quick answers for what would help tomorrow?
We just got to stay in our lane. In other words, not chase. But it's again, that's easier said than done. That changeup is so spectacular. We chased a lot. We were out of the zone a lot. And if a pitcher can get you outside of the zone, he's going to keep doing that. We have to be better in the zone. We have to force their pitchers in the zone more consistently and not miss your pitch when you see it. It really comes down to that. I don't know what the weather is specifically going to be like tomorrow night again, but we've been here before. Our guys have been ready to play. It's been really an interesting series. Both teams have reflected one another pretty closely, and they got us tonight, so we just have to fly back east and try to get them tomorrow night.
Okay. We'll take one last one here on the left.
Hey, Joe.
Yes, sir.
You've been here before, deciding games. One I think we can remember from last year. What are managers, players, coaches like in a winner-take-all game?
No. You know, the players are definitely going to be mentally involved. I mean, like they always are, but maybe even a little bit more. So coaches will go over their work a little bit more than they normally do. Although I'm really not an advocate of that. I just want us to go play. Just do our normal patterns. We prepare like this for every series, not just this series. So do our normal prepare normally. The difference would be, like, we're talking about Quintana's available out of the bullpen tomorrow night. Lester was available tonight. That's unusual. Obviously, or you don't even do that during a regular season. But for the most part, just if we could stay in our lanes at the plate, make sure that we see our pitches over the plate to swing at, and continue to play with the same kind of mental intensity, I'll be fine.
Thanks, Joe.
You got it.
All right, there you go. Cubs manager Joe Maddon talking after the game about what happened tonight, but also what is the expectation for tomorrow night. Mark Carmen, Andy Mazur in studio. Quick, guys, just around the horn, what do you think of what Maddon said, and do you echo the sentiment about tomorrow and everything that we should be prepared for?
Interesting that he's going to have Q there. Andy and I were debating that. Mm-hmm. I think it makes sense. Certainly it's going to be someone, and that if they somehow get through, that might set up John Lackey in game one of the NLCS. No one's really worried about that right now. The other thing is, like, I like what he's saying. Hey, man, it's on the hitters to step up and have better at-bats. I think he just laid it out there, and I think they'll come out, and I think they will show it.
If you don't score, you don't win. Simple as that.
There you go. Andy Mazur, Mark Carmen in studio. It's True Blue Playoff Plus. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back, and we'll continue to break down what we saw in Game 4 and get ready for Game 5 tomorrow. Game 5, winner take all in the NLDS between the Nationals and the Chicago Cubs. It's WGN 720. Stay with us.
As Sean Doolittle makes it a 1-2-3-9. Michael A. Taylor, the moment of his career, a Grand Slam postseason homer to make it 5-0. And the Nationals, on the brink of elimination, know they are going home for Game 5.
It's True Blue Playoff Plus. I'm Justin Kaufman, Andy Mazur, and Mark Carmen in studio. We are breaking down what we saw tonight in Game 4. The Nationals' victory over the Cubs at Wrigley, and what we can expect from Game 5 tomorrow. We heard Joe Maddon, Andy, talk that Kyle Hendricks is going to start tomorrow, Game 5. Dusty Baker says?
Well, Dusty is saying that he is undecided about Game 5. Mm. His quote from postgame says, "We'll see how everybody is feeling," end quote. Said he would likely start either Roark or Gio Gonzalez.
Interesting. So Tanner Roark is still in there. I would assume it's going to be Gonzalez, and then I wonder
about Scherzer.
And yeah, I wonder, where is Scherzer in the equation? Is he coming out of the bullpen in the fifth? Is he? He's definitely going to be available.
Mm-hmm.
Are they all available? I mean, they've got a very deep bullpen anyway, so it's not like they necessarily need all of them. So you know, it's an all hands on deck Game 5-er. The question to me is, can Kyle Hendricks do it again?
Yeah.
Because he was so phenomenal in Game 1.
What's your gut? I mean, he have, of course, a location pitcher. He had them stymied in the sense that he's mixing up his stuff. But can you do that twice in one series?
My gut has been disgusting this whole series. It's been a gross gut. I just have never really felt like going into it, I didn't think they were winning it deep down. And then they win Game 1, I'm like, you know, on cloud 9. And then you blow Game 2. And really, I mean, the bullpen's been a huge issue. So there's a lot of things going on, obviously, tomorrow. I mean, who are the Cubs pitching in the eighth inning? Let's say that it's a 3-1 game or 3-2 game or whatever, 1-0, doesn't matter. Who do you trust?
Absolutely, right.
I mean, he's going to say he trusts Carl Edwards, but deep down, how can you really trust him?
Well, it's going to be, you know, if it's a close game, I think it comes down to two guys. And you're probably looking at Pedro Strop from the right side, and you're probably looking at Mike Montgomery from the left.
No, I think Mike Montgomery's an interesting name that should be thrown in there. Like, why not go to Montgomery in the eighth and forget about the lefty thing? Mm-hmm. Just let him go.
No, I agree. I mean, especially if Montgomery's been starting, so you're pitching against lefties and righties. It's not like it's a situation where you're a left-handed specialist, because he's not. This is a starting pitcher.
If the Cubs have the lead, let's say in the middle of the eighth inning, and they start going to the bullpen, and maybe it's Strop or maybe it's Montgomery, do we see the same kind of thing where Wade Davis comes out early and tries to get a 2-inning save?
You're hoping not. I mean, I would certainly hope not if I'm the Cubs, because...
But that's, I mean, look at the best teams in the playoffs. They are going to bring their closers in the eighth inning, seventh inning in some cases.
Joe Maddon will do it.
He'll do it, but I'm hoping that it doesn't come to that, because we have seen... It's not always the magic cure. And I know a lot of fans will say, well, you got to, you know, sometimes the save is in the sixth inning. Okay, yeah, I get that. but it's not for your closer. It's for your bullpen guys to get that so you can get it to your closer who is in his normal role. Andrew Miller last year was such an aberration because he had closer stuff, but he also had the possibility he can go multiple innings.
Right.
So forget about that.
But Kenley Jensen's another example in L.A. I mean, they'll bring him
but
in
the
seventh
guys.
Inning.
But they're different guys. They're different kinds of pitchers.
Absolutely. But, right. I mean, you just have to know that they expected Wade Davis to pitch in multiple innings per game getting ready for a playoff run in October.
I mean, I just think about the psychology of it. Like, you go out there, you're in this huge pressure-packed eighth-inning situation. You get out of it. You naturally, like any human being, you're going to exhale. And then you got to go back out there and do it again.
Rev it up.
You know, it's not an easy thing to do. I mean, none of the stuff that they do out there is easy. These guys are professionals. They're incredibly talented, all of it. But it's a huge ask. And with the way the Cubs bullpen is, I think they probably will give the ask. If
I love
it gets
having
there.
The analysts in studio, 312-981-7200, because I'll pose a question for you from the Washington Nationals viewpoint. You're talking about two starting pitchers. One, Gio Gonzalez, who already pitched in the series.
Right.
Does the advantage go to a Gio who has already seen this lineup or Tanner Roark? But Tanner Roark had a 4.67 ERA in the season. He gives up big runs, big innings. I mean, he's not necessarily a lockdown pitcher. He's not even barely on the playoff roster. What do you do? I mean, who's got the advantage if you're the Washington Nationals starter tomorrow?
Well, if you're going to say that the starter that they haven't seen, I mean, it's Roark, but he doesn't have the same stuff that Gio Gonzalez does. I mean, the Cubs have seen Gonzalez in Nationals Park in the last week. So, I mean, I don't think he has the advantage over them at all, unless he hasn't shown some of his pitches that he might go to maybe more this time around. Usually the first time through the order, the pitcher's got a little bit of an advantage just because he knows his game plan. He knows how he's going to try to get you out. He's seen some more at-bats that you've taken since the last time he faced you. Instead of starting you out with a fastball, he might start you out with a curveball or a slider or a changeup.
Is it possible that we see a Roark, Gonzalez, Scherzer, all-star game to the Game 5 situation?
It's possible Dusty Baker sleeps tonight and wakes up and says Max Scherzer is going to start. I mean, we've seen that. I mean, this is Game 5.
There's no doubt. Who knows what Dusty's going to do, and just the way that today went was super bizarre.
Circus.
But I think that if I'm Dusty, I'm thinking of it this way. Do I want to throw a lefty against this Cubs lineup, or do I want to throw a righty? If you throw a lefty, you're going to see Almora. You're going to have Schwarber out of the lineup. If I throw a righty, Schwarber's going to be in there. And it seems like Dusty is afraid of Schwarber. Certainly the way he's pitched, the way he's at least maneuvered his bullpen has indicated that. I would think that Gio's going to go. And then it'll be interesting with Joe because he let off Almora in Game 2. And that did not go particularly well. I think Almora plays, but I don't think he leads off. So do you lead off Zobrist? That's what I would do.
Yep.
What we'll do. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back, and let's talk about the lineups we saw tonight and what we'll see tomorrow. Also, this is very important, is kind of breaking down the Chicago Cubs hitters in the way that they have now had two lackluster, difficult outings against Steven Strasburg. There were no hit by Max Scherzer. Are we at a point where you're concerned about the Chicago Cubs offense not particularly coming through in the clutch here coming up in Game 5? Those are the questions that are on the table. 312-981-7200. Andy Mazur, Mark Carmen in studio. We'll be right back.
Arrieta dueling Zimmerman. Rounded up the middle. And off the glove of Addison Russell, and that's going to score a run.
True Blue Playoff Plus post game. The Chicago Cubs lose to the Washington Nationals in Game 4, but they now have a do or die situation in Washington tomorrow night. The rain delay, of course, yesterday that forced this day off to essentially be a game. Does it hurt either of the teams that they have to go travel tonight and play this game tomorrow?
They're used to it. This is how it works in the regular season. You play a game at home, you fly wherever you're going to fly, and you're playing that night. I think it's such a routine. I don't think it bothers them. What I was saying earlier with Roe, it's a strange day at the ballpark when you have to come to the ballpark packed, hoping that you're not going to need your suitcase because you're going to close it out. And then you look at your suitcase, you need to pack it on the plane.
You're talking about a Nationals team getting on the plane right now feeling great. You're talking about a Cubs team getting on the plane feeling not as great, but I'm sure they're staying positive and they believe in themselves as they should. They've come through winning two in a row last year in Cleveland. They've won on the road a gazillion times. They won in L.A. They won in San Francisco. So they should be confident. I'm sure they are. But you hate to be in this position. Mm-hmm. You really do.
Mark Carmen, Andy Mazur, 312-981-7200. A lot of text message tonight about the questioning Madden about taking Lester out, and we kind of went over that as well. But let's talk about the Cubs lineup. And tomorrow, possibly Gio Gonzalez. I mean, it doesn't help that the fact that we don't know who the starter's going to be for the Nationals. But let's talk about they have been held in check. Chris Bryant had a great beginning to this series, and today 0-for-4 with 4 Ks. Rizzo was hitless. Addison Russell, 3 Ks, 0-for-4. And Javi Baez, 0-for-3 as well. And crucial situation with Zobrist on third. Also a double play late in the game. I mean, it doesn't seem like this team right now is clicking.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's an old saying in baseball that says good pitching usually stops good hitting. And we saw that today. Unfortunately, you know, you hate to do it, but you got to give the guy credit. I mean, whatever the situation was, antibiotics, sugar cubes, whatever they gave him to get him over whatever his mystery illness was, he went out there and pitched a great game. So, I mean, you have to give it to him in that respect. Now, what I hope Joe Maddon doesn't do tomorrow is try to tinker too much in trying to get a lineup started, because this is a lineup that's proven it can hit. It's proven it can hit. And I hate the tinkering during a postseason run when you know what you have by now. If you don't know what you have by now, you're in trouble. And this is a team that knows what it is, and I just hope he doesn't tinker too much. Lefty going up against a lefty or a righty, best player's got to play tomorrow.
It was an interesting tinker today. When they say they're going with Strasburg, he switches out Hayward for Schwarber. I don't quite understand the reasoning. I don't mind it.
That's defense, all defense.
Right,
especially with the wind today, that's the only reason that happened.
So, okay, so, I mean, you still need to catch the ball no matter who's on the mound. Mm-hmm. I'm just looking at the numbers right now. Rizzo's 4-for-15. Hayward's 2-for-8. I mean, those are your top two as far as batting average is concerned at 267 and 250. Everybody else is 200 or below. I mean, Zobrist 3-for-15. Bryant 3-for-15. Almora 1-for-5. Contreras 2-for-11. Russell 2-for-14. Jays 1-for-7. Javi's 0-for-9.
You could look at the Nationals lineup, and you could probably say you'll probably have the similar numbers.
Surprisingly, Bryce Harper.
No question.
Bryce Harper 0-for-3 with 2 Ks. And another guy who, or 1K, but another guy who, you know, you would expect much more. Another National who we hope continues the trend of having a difficult series is that of Daniel Murphy.
Yeah.
Daniel Murphy, a 330 hitter in the regular season, challenging for the batting title, just kind of disappeared. Although he did get a big hit in that eighth inning. But still, I mean, at the end of the day, he has kind of been in check, held in check.
No question. And that's a guy that Cub fans are terrified of, and the
series isn't over. You know?
Right. I mean, he can have a huge game five, so could Harper, so could any of them. That lineup is, there's a reason why the Nationals won 97 games. I mean, they're plenty capable. But outside of the eighth inning twice now, and Carl Edwards Jr., really, the pitching's been great.
This series has come down to three swings at the bat. I mean, let's paint it the way we see it here.
Harper,
Zimmerman, and Taylor.
Yep.
Today. I mean, those are the three swings of the bat that have made this an even series that has taken us to a game five.
Now, baseball is a game, you know, where a lot of things can happen one way or the other. But today I saw a Chicago Cubs team that was playing with fire. A couple times with the bases loaded where they got out of it. They were putting guys on in different positions. Addison Russell with the error. They did. I mean, even into the eighth inning, they shouldn't have been in that situation where they walked two guys. They put all, that was after a John Lester pickoff.
Yeah.
I mean, they've been doing this the entire game. They were bound to get burned.
Yeah, exactly right. Playing with fire the whole series long. They were lucky to get out of game three. I mean, Schwarber kicking around the corner. And today, and this is super nitpicking and they didn't score, but Ben Zobrist leads off or with one out in the third, I want to say, hits a rip shot double down the right field line. Well, Bryce Harper's taking his time to get there. The field's wet. Zobrist is moving. He's turning at second, looking, and Gary Jones is holding him up. And I'm like, hey, man, you're going up against Steven Strasburg. Make them make a perfect play. Now, the relay throw was way over the head of Murphy, so he would have stood up in the third. But he was stopped. Now, and then Russell makes the error. There's one run you could have had. I mean, Russell's bomb would have been a sacrifice fly. Now, it doesn't necessarily play out that way. I get it. Maybe the pitching's different. But if I'm the Cubs, I'm being aggressive on the base pass against with Steven Strasburg on the mound and on the mound, and they weren't right there.
Well, this is the time, Andy. I mean, this is it. It's game five, and you're gonna, you, like you said, last year they were here in the World Series, having to win two games in Cleveland to win the World Series. They've been here. Yeah. Anthony Rizzo wants the Nationals to respect him. I mean, is this crunch time? This is when stars are stars, and you become heroes.
Yeah.
So the idea right now is that you look at a Chris Bryant or an Anthony Rizzo or an Addison Russell or Javi Baez. It's time.
Yeah, and you know, like you said, they've been here, they've done that, they've been in situations that were much more magnified than this during the World Series, down 3-1. Each year is different. Obviously, this is not the same team that we saw last year. You know, this is not the same confident hitting team that we thought. You know, that we saw throughout the entire year last year. This was a team that really needed to strap it on and get through the second half of the season.
Kevin Powell is standing by Wrigley Field. He just caught up with Steven Strasburg's press conference. Kevin, thanks for joining us. Tough loss, but Steven Strasburg, what do you say? Did he reveal anything about his mystery illness?
No, nothing really that we haven't kind of learned over the past, basically what we learned today. But, guys, I do blame all three of you. I blame myself, and I blame all of the media for the drama around Steven Strasburg's start. That's according to the pitcher. He says the media created the drama around his start. It wasn't the fact that if the Nationals last night didn't just come out and say Strasburg's sick, there's a chance he could start. We'll see how he feels in the morning. Instead, there was this weird mystery, and Strasburg says the media created all the drama. So that's what he had to say after his dominant performance. You got to give him credit, guys. I mean, everything that's gone on in the past 24 hours, everything that was said about him, everything that was said about Baker, everything that was said about the team, and he comes through with that. I mean, I don't care. Nobody was hitting Strasburg today. I don't know what you guys have said about it, but he was untouchable today. I know some people thought the Cubs were overextending themselves at the plate or whatever. I don't care who was at the plate. Steven Strasburg was getting you out today. He was absolutely phenomenal.
Do you get any sense, Kevin, on which way the Nationals are going to go tomorrow on the mound?
Dusty says they don't know. He says it'll either be Gio or Tanner to start, likely. I think you're probably going to see a combination of Gio and Scherzer. That's my guess. I think Gio starts, and then you probably get Scherzer for a big chunk in the middle. We'll see how long Scherzer was available today. So you're going to see Scherzer tomorrow at some point.
At some point, right.
He's not going to start, but I don't think he is. Dusty was hinting that it's either going to be Gio or Roark. So I think you could even see all three of those guys. But I think it'll be Gio to start, and then probably Scherzer, and we'll kind of see where the game goes from there.
You know what? We got a little tape here of when Anthony Rizzo was asked by a reporter about hitting Strasburg today. Pete, go ahead and hit that.
How hard is it to hit Strasburg's change that's working?
Probably like you going over to sluggers and trying to hit. he throws that fastball and it rises, and then that changeup just falls off the planet. So basically anyone who goes to a batting cage and doesn't know how to hit, that's what it feels like.
There you go. That is something. It is nice to hear that Anthony Rizzo's got a little bit of humor in him as you get ready for Game 5. Kevin, at the park, I mean, how do the Nationals and the Cubs, do you feel any energy, any difference about what might how their temperament is going into Game 5?
Not really. I mean, it feels about the same coming into this game. I don't think much has changed for the Cubs. They're resilient. They're battle-tested. For the Nationals, this is a monstrous game for them. The window is going to keep closing year by year. And considering they haven't gotten past the first round in their last four tries, considering the amount of talent they have, they're at home. They get a dominant performance from Strasburg, who's been a cornerstone of this franchise. Harper, you can thank Harper for facing the franchise for tying things up in game two. So, you know, there's a lot riding on this game for the Nationals. I think the pressure's on them. I really do. So I think the Cubs will be approach the game like they always do, and like they have this entire series. But I think it's going to be another tight, fun game for sure.
There you go, Kevin Powell at Wrigley Field covering the Nationals. Steven Strasburg, of course, just doing his press conference. Kev, thanks for checking in, bud.
All right, guys, I'll talk to you.
All right, there you go. So as we wrap up here, I mean, Game 5, as you just heard, I mean, there doesn't seem to be any difference in terms of business as usual. What do we think? What do we think about what to expect from Game 5?
This is the time to break out the lucky underwear. This is the time to go to your favorite place. This is the time to be with the people that you feel most comfortable with. This is where you go all in on all your fandom. You do everything you possibly can to win the game tomorrow. For me, no negativity around me. I need positive people. I need good flow. I don't know if I can go to work tomorrow, and I'm just gonna have my fingers crossed all day, and let's just go.
Andy,
who is this guy?
Come on,
this is the same guy that I had to talk off the ledge down 3-1 of the World Series last year. And then we went Mr. Positive, and look what happened. So
exactly,
I like a little
right.
credit for that, by the way.
I was refusing to go negative when they were down 3-1. I thought it was very possible, yeah. And they came back,
yes,
and they did it.
Exactly.
Tomorrow is possible.
Hey, listen, tomorrow, the better team, the better prepared team, I think, is still the Cubs. I think a lot of people are overlooking what Kyle Hendricks was able to do in the last postseason, what he was able to do when healthy this season and even into the postseason. Let him overlook him. Because I really feel like this is the guy that the demeanor is absolutely perfect for a clinching and deciding type of a game. I really think Joe Maddon should have let him go a little deeper in Game 7 last year. We might not have had the craziness that we had. But again, that's revisionist history. I think that there's, when you hear that kind of humor coming out of the clubhouse, that's because these guys have been there before. Nothing is going to affect them at this point. Anthony Rizzo has shown himself as a leader, and it's a young leader, and I think that's a great thing going in.
Something to watch real quick is, you know, he started a little bit slow in Game 1 and was able to get out of some first and second inning jams. The Nationals hit some balls super hard.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully that will not be the case.
An early lead would be nice, yeah.
Yeah, so if he can just...
But, you know, we talked about this even after Game 1. The idea that Kyle Hendricks is the go-to pitcher for the Chicago Cubs has materialized. This is it. I mean, this is what we expected, a great second half. Here he comes. And, you know, frankly, this is do-or-die time, and it's good to see that the Chicago Cubs have their ace on the mound.
You know, and I kind of agree with Kevin. I mean, I really think that the pressure is all squarely on the Nationals. They had 97 wins. They won their division going away. They've never gotten past this first round. You don't know what it takes if you haven't been there before, and you know, they've had so many disappointments there that they can't probably help thinking to themselves if they get down early. Oh boy, here we go again.
Here we go.
We've been there, folks. We know what they think. You know, we know what they feel like.
Andy Mazur, Mark Carmen, True Blue Playoff Plus. Of course, Game 5 tomorrow night. What a tremendous, tremendous thing to have a Game 5 here in the NLDS for the Cubs. And like we said, as predicted across the board, this was going to be a 5-game series, and it is. Andy, Mark, thanks for joining us tonight.
My pleasure, Dustin.
See you.
Thanks, Rob. The download here at 720 WGN. What a day in Cook County politics and Cook County political history. The sweetened beverage tax is no more. Sunset December 31st will be the last of it. It loses in a landslide vote.
15-2.
15-2. Mike Fouché is here to explain it all from the dailyline.net. Mike, good to see you.
Good to be here.
Thanks for showing up a little bit later after
Tribune. Yeah, you know, I'm here later, so I feel like I'm going to be more real. You know? Yeah.
All right, so let's get into the story. This story, of course, has been bubbling up for the last week. We heard at the end of, I think it was on Friday, we just knew because all of the commissioners that had flip-flopped on the issue that it was going to be repealed. Today was the day.
Right. That's it. You know, it's gone. Well, it's not totally gone. It's sunsetted for the end of this year, so they don't have to figure out how to fix the budget for this year. But there definitely will be about a $200 million hole for the next year. And that's really the crux of the whole thing. You know, President Tony Preckwinkle kept saying, look, you know, you guys, if you're going to repeal this thing, it's on you. I'm not going to help you. I'm not going to try and figure out how to fix the problems. You got to fix it.
Are the commissioners responding to that? Because it just seems that the commissioners would be saying that's your job as the president.
No. I mean, they're talking all kinds of big talk. You know, I mean, the finance chair, John Daly, said, you know, I think that we can plug the hole. Richard Boykin, Commissioner Richard Boykin, who really was the leader of a lot of this, you know, said, oh, yeah, we've got all kinds of ways and we're going to cut all these extra jobs that are in the health and hospital system the county health and hospital system. And there's a lot of talk of cutting and maybe talk of some other revenue, although nobody's really got any real revenue.
Mike, one of the things that it almost falls into this category of perpetual stereotype or laziness for all of us when we say, you know, get rid of the government spending, the wasteful government spending. Is there wasteful government spending at the county level? We've talked about this a couple of times, but,
yeah.
But what is it? Where would the waste be in a Cook County government?
You know, that's a really good question. I mean, you know, Toni Preckwinkle is very proud of the fact that she puts it in her budget every year that she has cut thousands of jobs in county government since she first started. And, you know, the hospital system was a huge money loser when she started. It's turned around. It's actually growing by leaps and bounds through its own revenue. A large part of that is because of the expansion of Medicaid by Obamacare. But the fact is that it is no longer losing money. County government has really turned around a lot, and as has city government too. In Chicago, Rahm Emanuel has cut thousands and thousands of jobs, and state government is a lot smaller. You know, it's about I don't know percentage wise, but you know, more than 10 or 15, I think even 20,000 jobs in state government have been cut since the early noughts. So, you know, government overall is a lot smaller, much smaller than it was 20, 30 years ago. And of course, there's always waste, fraud, and abuse in government. You know, it's just the way it is. But it's not nearly as egregious as it used to be.
I always find it interesting, too, at this time, because we forget to sort of look at the idea that, what, $13-plus million was spent on both sides of this sweetened beverage tax lobby? Both the Cook County Board President and the people who were Michael Bloomberg and those who came in to run ads on the other side, the
right.
Beverage Association running $13-plus million,
yeah,
for us to essentially to win over our hearts one way or the other,
yeah,
on a soda tax.
Right.
I mean, there is something out of whack at the idea that that much money, the irony that that much money was spent.
Yeah,
and now here we are finding out where can we cut money.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I just feel like we're out of whack here.
These two sides had a lot at stake, right? I mean, the soda companies, the beverage companies were looking at this as basically the first smoking ban. And look what happened after New York City had their smoking ban. It was like dominoes. Now there's smoking bans across the United States. You can't smoke anywhere in public anymore in the United States. And I think that soda companies were looking at this as, oh, man, if Chicago passes this soda tax, you know, after Philadelphia and Chicago, it's a trend. And we're going to see this all over the country. So I think that they were willing to spend whatever it took.
Well, Mike, doesn't that, and I know this is out of our political purview in this conversation, but doesn't, I mean, it's startling to me that as a society that we would let a lobby essentially stop a health movement. And I know I'll get the text, and every time I bring it up, the idea that this wasn't about health, this was about revenue and Preckwinkle's lying to us. But at the end of the game, and Eric Zorn had a great column today, it is about health. That many in the health field, has medical field, have called out soda being liquid candy. This,
yeah,
idea that it causes a lot of trouble for the human body to us, and soda companies know it.
Yeah.
And they're not stopping it. If not, they're targeting different communities. There's so much in this that reminds me of the tobacco industry. And so the question just becomes like, yes, okay, the penny per ounce tax was rolled out. It stumbled. It wasn't a great tax. There was a lot of confusion, and quickly that gave lobby a lot of opportunity to rile up the base. But at the end of the day, what's left?
Well, I'll start off by saying that I actually have no soul anymore because I've been covering politics for a long time, and I don't really even think about issues that matter. I think about the politics of the whole thing.
Right.
So, you know, you're talking about, well, people are getting sick and dying and getting diabetes and stuff like that. Well,
yeah,
that's just mumbling to me. I don't hear it. It's buzz and clicks is here,
okay,
kid.
All right.
So, I mean, basically, I mean, from a political perspective, you want to look at it, and Toni Preckwinkle did a horrendous job of rolling this out. She led with the idea that she's going to have a tax before she made a case about why it is that it needed to be something, a health issue that needed to be addressed. You know, a better way would have been talking about a health issue for a number of months long before the tax was introduced, so that people have in their mind that this is something that has to be taken care of. The second is that I think that when Preckwinkle rolled it out, she really didn't soften the ground with political leaders, you know, saying to them, all right, I want you to know you're going to get phone calls every single day from the corner store owners and everybody else that are going to be complaining about this. I mean, really, from the perspective of small mom and pop or just small retail stores, this is a big issue for them.
Yeah.
You know, gas stations have really slammed by cigarette tax in Illinois and in Chicago. The idea that, you know, really what these places where they make a lot of their money is that last minute decision as you're filling up your car, you go get a Coke and whatever, a Coke and Cheetos. And the idea that there's now this tax that would be hitting them, that's where a lot of their profits are. So I don't think that Preckwinkel had really thought through that.
Well,
through.
And the other, and why don't we do this? We'll take a break because I want to come back and I want to ask about the political side of this, ramifications of the flip-flop. The commissioners who voted, I mean, there was an 8-8 tie that was broke by Preckwinkel before there was this mass pressure.
Right.
Now it is, what was the end? It was 15-2. I mean, this idea that many of them flipped because it was politically expedient or because their constituents were saying, I don't like this. I mean, that's what we're going to find out because a lot of these names that flip, they have ambitions for other offices and they don't want to be on the campaign trail when they're running for mayor saying, you supported the tax of the blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Mike Fouché, DailyLine.net in studio. We'll take a quick break. Stay with us. Mike Fouché in studio tonight, Daily Line, as he is every Wednesday, a little later tonight, 312-981-7200. It's the download. I'm Justin Kaufman. We're talking about the sweetened beverage tax, which is the political story of the day. Mike, flip-flops. A good thing? I mean, is that a good thing for these? I mean, there was constituents that came out. You talked about the small business owners that came out. They registered their complaints to commissioners. John Daly, kind of the beginning of it. Chewy Garcia, Bridget Gaynor. These are very progressive Democrats who had voted for the tax, and now that there's a little bit more pressure on it, voted against it. I mean, is this a sign of them listening to their constituents, or is this a sign that they want to be in other offices in the future and they don't want this baggage to follow them around?
Well, let's start with the I'm dead, I have no soul analysis here, which is that the truth is that it is really, really rough to get reelected as Cook County Commissioner if you have a real challenge. And for a lot of these people, this is the most, a lot of these commissioners, this is the most attention that constituents have paid to them ever. I mean, let's be honest here. Can you name who your Cook County commissioner is? Chances are probably not.
Right.
And the idea that there were hundreds, thousands of people activated to write letters, make phone calls is utterly terrifying to these people. And really, when you're thinking about a Cook County commissioner, what are you thinking about them for? Jails, you know, the hospitals and the forest preserve and property taxes. None of those things really get people fired up and excited in a positive way.
Right.
So when you're running for Cook County commissioner, even if you're being reelected, it's a rough go of it in order to raise money and then get people excited about you. You know, how do you campaign? I'm going to have better slides at the forest preserve. You know, I mean, that really doesn't get people excited. And so it's hard for them to raise the money. It's hard for them to put together a campaign. And the idea that all of these people came out against it, yeah, they're going to flip-flop pretty fast.
Does it have to do with political futures? I mean, when you think of some of the names, Chewy Garcia was a surprise to me because he's going to run as a progressive. He may, his name already bandied about a little bit for the next municipal election.
He's floating the balloon that he wants to run for mayor again. You know, Commissioner Bridget Gaynor is telling people that she's thinking about it too. And, you know, sure.
When they're pressed, did they not believe in the issue, the health issues around it? Did they even bring that kind of stuff up, or are they just really just riding the wave that is we nickel and dime the residents?
I think that they say, well, I know, you know, a lot of them say this is just an overwhelming opposition from our constituents, and we just have to go against it. You know, I think that from a purely political calculus perspective, it was not a hard vote for these people.
Tony Preckwinkel came out with a statement today, talked about tough decisions you have to make as a Cook County Board President and also how you have to stand down when the decision isn't going your way. her political future. There's a lot of people just automatically blaming her for this fiasco, and then also saying, you know, even the commercials will remember. I mean, there's this idea that Tony Preckwinkle's political future is in jeopardy. Is that the case? I mean, does it seem like Tony Preckwinkle could have trouble from this?
No, and I think that's a completely different kind of thing. You know, first off, Tony Preckwinkle, this is the apex of her career. You know, she will run for re-election. She'll probably do it one more time. You know, a lot of people are expecting that the next one would be her last term if she's reelected. So it's not like she has a long runway that she's thinking about and what's going to happen. And it's much easier to raise money, and she already has very high name ID as the president of the Cook County Board. So it's not a whole big challenge for her to get reelected. And she will probably have enough resources left over in order to mess up the lives of some other people.
Well, I hope personally that people do run against her and they use this issue to attack her, only because I think that she needs a do-over in explaining how important this issue as a health issue is to the residents of Cook County. And I think she does a good job when she explains it. Like you said, she just did a kind of a poor job in rolling it out. Is this the end of the sweetened beverage tax in Cook County? I mean, Yes. They're going to sunset it, but is there a chance that when they're trying to fill a $200 million hole that they go, maybe half a penny a pound?
No. And in fact, I think that this was hugely unpopular. There was some expectation that a year ago, that if it stuck around and there wasn't a lot of opposition to it, maybe there would be a state one. But this was handled so poorly and so badly. I think it's done. And it's probably done nationally, because I don't think anybody wants to deal with this kind of headache.
Until it causes you headaches.
Right. Well, you know, diabetes aside, I mean, the health issues are real. And, you know, I know plenty of people who've said, you know, once I stopped drinking 4 Diet Cokes a day or, you know, whatever, I started losing a lot of weight. And
or just being healthier, feeling better.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that that's all true, but that's not necessarily what we're talking about here today.
Yeah. As we look to the future, a $200 million hole for next year, Bridget Gaynor was on Cochran, I think it was this morning, saying that, hey, you know, we've got 6 weeks. That's what this 6 weeks is for, to think of new ideas, to really scrutinize the budget. How do they do this? I mean, is it going to be a series of cuts? I mean, where are they going to find the money to cut to balance with $200 million removed from the budget?
I think that we're going to see positions cut to some degree. And I think that they're going to be scrambling and come up with as many different ways. Nobody knows. I mean, you know, there's a whole bunch of ideas that are being floated. Nobody really knows. And you do have 3 weeks or so of budget hearings. I think the vote on the budget isn't until the 16th of November. You know, so there's plenty of time between now and then. But
it's not really that much time. It's October 11th.
Well, you know,
it's a month.
All you need is
I didn't even
mention
the
good ideas.
The Cook County vacation schedule. The commissioner vacation
schedule.
That's true.
And
they got to service those high back leather chairs. That's 2 days off. They got a lot of days off coming up here.
There are a lot. I've sat through these hearings. They have every single department in the county comes through, and they all tell their story. And I think they're all going to be asked, all right, how do you come up with 10%? You know, where do you cut 10%? Yeah. And a lot of them, they have cut in the past. So they're all going to be trying to figure out how to do that.
Yeah. Mike Fouché from The Daily Line joins us every Wednesday here on The Download to talk politics. Tonight, the Cook County variety. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, it's great being real with you.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, this weekend, Evanston Township High School's having a celebration. The Yamo Sketch Review is turning 60 this year. It's just a famous student-run comedy show that has been a tradition at Evanston Township High School since 1958. Several notable alumni are coming back for weekend festivities, including my next guest, Matt Price. Price is a comedy actor and writer in Hollywood, showing up on shows like Arrested Development, The Office, New Girl, and Transparent, just to name a few. He's also worked for a few years on the Cartoon Network hit Regular Show and is now a producer on the new TBS show Close Enough, the animated show from the creators of the Regular Show. Matt Price, a friend of The Download, welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I love being friend of The Download.
We consider you a friend.
Everything he said is fine. That's the only part I heard was friend of the download.
So this is a big weekend for you to come back, celebrating 60th anniversary or a year for YAML. Talk about your experience with it, because this is, like I said, it's a pretty famous student-run comedy review.
Yeah, so I loved YAML. It was a big part of my life, or my high school life. Just, I should say, it's also like, it's comedy, it's singing, it's dancing. It's like a big, you know, it was a big show every fall. And it was a big part of my life because it was the first time I wrote and performed with my peers. And it was such a revelation to me that you could do that, you know, when you were 16, 17. And it's sort of, I think looking back on it, I'm like, oh, I guess it instilled something in me where that's just what I wanted to do forever. And I've been, you know, fortunate enough to be able to do that. So,
yeah.
In my professional life.
Well, talk about the show for those who've not seen it, and mostly a lot of people out there who may not have kids at Evanston Township High School or know about YAML. Where does it come from? And talk a little bit about the process of putting it together.
Sure. So, yeah, as you said, YAML's been around for 60 years. It's basically students get together. There's a small group of students who get together and write it. It's all written and produced by the students. It's probably my memory when I was a kid. It was like two-thirds acting, you know, scene, you know, it's sort of a, there's a small through line that goes to the show. And then there's some great songs that I still sing today in the shower and such. And there's a little dance number. But they, you know, all the students put it together. And then there's this amazing crew, students. It's all students. It's a crazy thing. To me, it was such a crazy thing.
Yeah.
Maybe it's not as crazy. But
no,
it
absolutely is. a lot of things could go right. A lot of things can go wrong when it's all student run.
Yeah, exactly.
To be a part of the alumni that's coming back to the high school this weekend, and it's a benefit for the performing arts across the board at Evanston Township High School. What does it mean to you as to be an alumni and get an opportunity to come back and be able to do it again?
It means a lot. You know, I have to be honest, like when my reunion came and went, that wasn't something I felt really drawn to go to. Some of my closest friends are still from my high school, but I felt really drawn, and I still talk to them all the time, and I'm going to see them this weekend. But I felt really drawn to go to this YAML weekend because, like I said, it was just a really important part of my life, and it made me, even just the hanging out, I realized that was such a big, I don't know if this is you, because I know you come from a comedy background too, but like, even just the idea that like, oh, you do the show and then you're hanging out and talking about the show.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean? There's that just camaraderie and you're like, oh, suddenly I'm in Koreatown and I'd never done this before. It just opened the door to all these new experiences for me as a junior and senior. And it helped me find my voice, just my writing voice.
There's all sorts of improv groups and sketch groups when you get to college, and you're seeing more and more of this in every college, university in America, everywhere, actually, we're across the globe. But in high school, it's still the high school play, perhaps, or maybe a talent show here or there. But to have the ability to be involved in a comedy music review at such a young age, it's not surprising that that's the area in which you've excelled in your career.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't even know if I've excelled, but it's just what I've
I think you've excelled.
I don't know. I can't, like, I could also be going back to curse YAML because it's put me on this path. Maybe.
Maybe.
It's YAML's fault.
It's YAML's fault. YAML, the 60th anniversary of the sketch music review at Evanston Township High School happening this weekend. It's a benefit for the Evanston Township High School Performing Arts. Matt, last time we had you on the show, we were talking about the Cartoon Network hit Regular Show, which was such Regular Show was such a huge hit, not just for kids, but for adults as well, has played the tremendous success it's had at Comic-Cons and all over the world when it comes to sort of being a counterculture cartoon program. You guys have been able to move that into a TBS primetime show, Close Enough, which starts in the late spring, early summer next year. Talk about that. Mm-hmm. Talk about Close Enough and the idea of moving from a kid's show to a primetime adult show.
I mean, I love it. I mean, well, Close Enough, it's about a family of three living in L.A. and how they have to live with their they want their daughter to go to a better school, so they have to live with their two best friends, a recently divorced couple, and they all live together in kind of a cramped apartment. So it's about like sacrifices you make when you're a young adult, and it's a pretty basic premise. But just like Regular Show, it gets very weird every episode. You know, that's what I love about it. It's just a cool take on a family, like a young family, but with all the weirdness of Regular Show. As far as getting into it, it was cool because I came from more adult comedy, like I wrote for Comedy Central, and just, you know, was developing things that were more adult oriented. So then to be able to do that again now is it's cool.
Is the goal for the creators and for you as one of the producers to parlay the success you had from Regular Show? Because it's very similar animation. It may not be the same characters, but it's the same sensibility. It's just now you get to say words that you couldn't say necessarily on Cartoon Network. Is the idea to bring that audience, that very rabid, loyal audience, to TBS and to Close Enough?
Yeah, I think so. I think, I mean, J.G. Quintel, who created Regular Show, has a big fan base, and he's a super talented dude. And I think the hope for him and TBS is that people who are fans of Regular Show will see a lot of that humor. Like, we can, they'll have that humor, but we can also now say diarrhea.
All right.
So it's cool.
So now that really opens up your toolbox as a writer and a producer, right?
Yeah, yeah. And every episode, frankly, is pretty diarrhea-based.
That's really what you were hired for, and then you realized they weren't sure if it was a fit or not. Now you have the opportunity on the primetime.
Yeah, finally. It's diarrhea, like, I'm known in Los Angeles as, like, the diarrhea guy, right, and now I can come out here and do it.
It's good to see all that work has paid off.
But it is cool. Seriously, we talk about more than diarrhea. Yeah. And it's, but we do get to dive into a lot of, you know, obviously adult themes, relationships. I don't know, just diving into what we deal with every day with real people as the main characters. So it's great.
And I asked you this before when you were in studio last couple years back when we talked about being a part of Regular Show. Does this blow your mind about having a show, especially a show on Cartoon Network, that had such a rabid following that does have that Comic-Con presence, that people are dressing like the characters? For you guys to be able to part, like I said, be able to move on and do Close Enough on TBS, but does it blow your mind that there's so much fandom around the product that you guys were producing?
Yeah, it always did. That was always the best part about going to Comic-Con, was seeing the fans. I mean, first of all, I feel like when you write on a TV show or in a TV show, you don't, you know, there is a lag time from when it airs, so you don't, and obviously you're watching it at home, so you don't get to meet the people who are really loving it. With Twitter now, you see it more, and Instagram and stuff, you see the love of it, but to be in person, to see people in costume and people running up to you, like, I had a very, very small part on Regular Show. I played a character who was a stand-up comedian, Yeti, and I was on two episodes. But there was a dude that came to one of the Comic-Cons dressed as me, like, as my character. And that's insane to me. Like, the smallest character on the show, and there's someone dressing up as that. That's dedication.
As a writer and as a producer, have you had to adjust in your career to writing for animated programs as opposed to what you've done in the past? Like you mentioned, Comedy Central and other places. I also know you to be, I show up on all the great shows as an actor. But do you have to adjust your writing when you're writing for animation?
I mean, I think you always have to adjust your writing to write for the creator, like whatever he or she is looking for. So you're adjusting there. And I think you're just taking your voice and making it, you know, bringing the best of your own voice to whatever they want. But I think that then, yes, there's an added layer when you're writing for animation. I think luckily for me, our show, like JG wanted a really grounded show. And then it got very surreal, obviously. But like we could start from a real place, you know, with real problems and real friendships that were driving everything. But then, yes, then you had to, I at least had to learn like, oh, but I guess now he can also be talking to a burrito.
Right, that's the regular,
which isn't normally
show, right,
what you're writing about.
Right.
But so in that regard, it's cool because it really opens up your mind. And then when you're back to writing, I guess, a more live action thing,
yeah,
your mind is open,
talk, right.
You know?
You in this role, you're more of a supervising producer as opposed to a writer that you were with Regular Show. What are the differences? What does it mean to produce on an animated program?
I mean, honestly, I'm still doing a ton of writing. It's almost just like it's just a fancier title. That's really all. But I'm involved in more decisions and stuff. When I was on Regular Show as a writer and story editor, I was really just involved in the writing. But then now I get to be very involved in the writing. I'm involved in the records when we do them every Monday. I'm involved in, you know, when we put it together sometimes with the animatic, it's called, like the final stage. Like, I'm just more involved in all the stages.
Yeah.
But really, you know, it's a fancy writer title.
Oh, well, you take it. You deserve that
Friend
fancy writer.
The download is honest.
That's right. Matt Price, my guest tonight, writer.
Can I give you the website?
Go ahead. Go ahead. Yep.
Oh, were you going to do it?
Well, I was just going to say Google it, but you can give the website.
I'll be your Google tonight.
Yeah. Matt, what's the website for Yamo?
Oh, okay. Thank you. It's www.yamo60th.com. That's www.yamo60th.com.
There you go.
And it's this weekend, a big show Sunday.
A big show on Sunday. Matt Price, writer and producer for the show Close Enough and also a regular show, which was such a huge hit on Cartoon Network, plus a slew of other stuff out in Hollywood. We'll be back in town this weekend for the big show on Sunday at Evanston Township High School for the Yamo 60th anniversary. Matt, thanks for joining us tonight, and congratulations on the fancy title.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on. Hashtag friend of the download.
I love the regular show. It's regular show. It's not the regular show, but nasty article kind of gets in the way. Saying a sentence, I say regular show, but I say you can't actually start it regularly. You just say the. Anyway, you know what I mean. Good to have Matt Price back on. I that show plus Adventure Time. Some of the other shows, Adult Swim shows, Cartoon Network has had such a line of successful programs. And Regular Show and Adventure Time are two of the biggest. And it really is true. I take my son to some of the Comic Cons, and it is a Adventure Time, Regular Show bonanza. Think about people going crazy. Because it is a crossover cartoon. It just ended. Its final season was last year. But it's a crossover where you get a lot of adults who like it, yet it's for kids, sort of. When I would watch it with my son, who probably at the time, eight years old, I was like, every time you're like, this is getting a little too close to the edge. But they always pulled it back out. Mostly, they were really into 80s, 90s, kind of throwback pop culture references without being specific, very generic. A lot of electric guitar. A lot of electric guitar solos from cartoon characters. It was good. It was a lot of fun. So Matt Price. I'm looking forward to that show. Close Enough, coming up on TBS. I think he said in the pre that it's coming out May or June next year. All right, coming up, Michael Kutz is going to join us, the longtime founder of the Chicago International Film Festival, which starts tomorrow. This is his first year where he's transitioning out of being the artistic director, moving to a larger role as CEO, where he's not necessarily in the hands, the day-to-day operations of the festival. We'll talk about that transition and also talk about the business behind film festivals and how it's changed for him. This is his 53rd year. To think about, go back to 1964, we'll talk to him about the early days of the festival and how film festivals have changed. Chicago International Film Festival is the longest-running competitive film festival in North America. And it's right here in Chicago. Tomorrow, Phil Marshall kicks it off. There's a lot of great people here. Patrick Stewart's here this week. There's a lot of Josh Gad's in Marshall. He'll be here tomorrow for the opening. John Lovitz is coming to town. There's so many different. Alfre Woodard. There's a lot of great talent that'll be in Chicago in the next couple weeks. So we'll talk with Michael Kutzen. Coming up as well, 10 o'clock. Greg Flamm and the swap meet. I'm looking forward to talking. Last week we got on a roll talking about t-shirts. Talking about all the fun concert t-shirts we've collected over the years. 312-981-7200. And frankly, this has happened the last couple times on the swap meet. We've had a steady flow of calls and texts. And then right around 10:50, 10:55, everyone goes, oh, I've got an idea. And the lines light up and the texts come in and it almost becomes like a blur. And I can't get to them. And then I go, you know what? Next week, go ahead and text in next week. And then they don't until 10:50. And they go, oh, yeah, I forgot to text. I'll text in again. So let's change the – let's start that a little bit earlier. That's earlier in the 10 o'clock hour.
Right, because they're probably listening at 10. They're like, oh, my God, I got to go down to my basement. And then they're down there for 45 minutes digging, and then they come back up. And they now start digging now.
Bring in their
transistor radio down, or the Echo, right, or the Dot, or the Dash.
Your battery-powered transistor.
Listen down there, and then you'll be ready to go at 10:05.
Get the old construction helmet with the light on it, you know? Like you're in a South American cave. You're spelunking. But instead of trying to find crazy species, you're trying to find that Star Wars toy you had in 1978. That's right. 312-981-7200. Thank you, Rob. Let's download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, the 53rd Annual Chicago International Film Festival gets underway tomorrow night and runs through the 26th of October. Tomorrow begins with the highly anticipated film Marshall. And that's just one of the over 150 films from over 25 different countries. The festival is the longest-running competitive film fest in North America, and the stars will be out with tributes to Alfred Woodard, Patrick Stewart, Vanessa Redgrave, and Michael Shannon, just to name a few. It started back in 1964. But my guest tonight, founder and now CEO of the parent company that runs the Chicago International Film Festival, Michael Kutza. Kutza started with just a handful of films and has developed the festival into one of the most prestigious of its kind. The longtime artistic director stepped aside this year for the first time, handing the reins to longtime festival programmer Mimi Pluchet, but he still is working alongside her with the programming for the festival. Joining me tonight, the big table, Michael Kutza. Michael, thanks for being here.
Thank you for inviting me. That was absolutely exhausting listening to that. I'm thinking that there are 26 more days to go or something like that.
Well, let's talk about this festival, because putting a festival like this together, I mean, you know, I want to get into your history, especially going back to when you began this thing. But to have 150 different films, to have 25 different countries represented, I mean, you're talking about a year of planning to find these movies to bring this in. So this is a year-long
effort. It's funny because you're using my script for tomorrow, because when I introduce the whole festival tomorrow night, one of the things I'm going to say to the audience is, it's taken a year to get where we are tomorrow night. A whole year of Mimi and myself traveling the world and our team finding these films, lining up the actors and directors and all, and getting the best of the best and bring it back to Chicago.
Is that how it works? I mean, you're going to different festivals and whatever grabs your eye, you're like, I want that in Chicago?
That's how it always started, but we do more than that. So we'll do screenings in L.A., screenings in London and Paris and all, because we've become such a point after 53 years, the countries and the film institutes and all and the distributors want us to show their films, and we go there as well as the festivals in Cannes or Berlin or you name it. I sent Mimi, where did I send her today? Cartagena, I think. This first, she'd never been to Colombia. I said, you should go discover Colombia. Besides the drugs, they're movies. They're movies there, dear.
I mean, but that's quite an undertaking to be able to go to all these different festivals and bring. I mean, with all the travel and everything that you go in, I mean, does it become somewhat of a chore? I mean, you can be in these festivals watching 5, 6, 7 films.
We both do about 5 a day. If it was a chore, I certainly would not be doing it for 50 years. I think it has to be the energy of these directors and these films that keep you going, you know?
You
love what you're doing all these years because there's something that makes you love it, right?
What are you looking for in these films? What is it that makes
new
a film?
Energy, new people, things you haven't seen before, or things you've seen in a brand new way? Yeah, it's exciting.
Okay, so is there a certain mission statement or philosophy that you and Mimi approach films when you're talking about the Chicago International Film Festival? Because you have had an opportunity in your career to discover new talent that became mainstream Hollywood talent. But
that's the secret. The secret always was at the beginning to show first-time directors. That was always the beginning of this festival, to find the first time. Show me your first film or your second film. That's what we want. That's how it started. So back in, let's say, 67, some kid sent us a film. I think his name was Martin Scorsese. It's true. That's where Roger Ebert was starting his job. He just got out of University of Illinois. And he covered the festival for his first job. And he saw this film by Martin Scorsese. And he took it on like his little mantle and fell in love with it and him. Written books about him and became lifelong friends with Scorsese.
Now, the festival tomorrow, you're going to start a couple weeks worth of films that aren't just going to be first-time directors. There's going to be a lot of different...
A good percentage are first-time directors.
So how do you find that match of the first-time director plus the films that you know are going to have the notoriety that are going to bring the audiences in with esteemed veteran
The secret has always been, even back at the very beginning, I knew nobody wanted to come see a new film from Romania or Hungary or even Italy. In America, we only knew French movies. It was the only kind of foreign film we ever saw back in as a kid. So I knew that you had to open with a Hollywood film or something to capture you, and then if I could get you in that night, you might hang around the next day and see something from Brazil.
You know, for you, the International Film Festival, the Chicago International Film Festival, has grown. It's 53rd year. How important is it to have the big names, the big Hollywood films? You just mentioned to get you in the door, but then also the tributes, Alfred Woodard, Patrick Stewart.
Very important, even from the very beginning. The very first year of the festival, even though I was a kid, I had Bette Davis, King Vidor. I'm sure you've never heard of King Vidor. Amazing silent film director. And Stanley Kramer at the first film festival.
And you know what? Festival. What I wanted more than ever to do for the entire hour.
Chicago is star-starved.
Still.
I was a kid. I wanted stars here. I wanted.
See, that's it. I wanted to spend the whole hour just talking about the pump room. I know. There's so much we could do just about the beginnings of the Chicago International Film Festival. Michael Kutza in studio. Marshall starts the festival tomorrow. It's got a lot of buzz. Josh Gad is in it. He's going to be there. A lot of others as well. Why this film? Why this film to start the festival?
All right. It all works on history. So this film is produced by a young lady that I've known for 25 years named Paula Wagner. It means nothing to you. Paula Wagner invented Tom Cruise. She was his agent and publicist back then. And she came here one year. We were honoring Tom Cruise, his 10th year. We gave him an actor of decade. He made his first film in Chicago. I said, okay. Tom comes. I meet Paula. We became lifelong friends. Paula produces films now. She did all the Mission Impossible stuff, and she does Spielberg films. And so Mimi and I are in Hollywood this year looking for product. I said, let's call Paula. I said, maybe she's got something new. And I'll tell you more about Paula because she's coming to Chicago with her Broadway show. Paula said, yeah, I've been working on something for a year. I don't know what I'm going to do with it. I'm not doing festivals. I'm doing careful marketing and with lawyers and judges around the country. Okay, maybe it's your opening night. I said, maybe it is. Let's take a look at it. And Mimi and I fell in love with it and thought, interesting Chicago angle, because Hudlin is from Illinois. We say Chicago with some of his early work. So I thought, okay, there's an angle there.
How important is it for you to make sure that there is that angle?
I like Chicago talent, and I think it's important that we honor Chicago talent. We have whole sections of the festival of Chicago and Illinois filmmakers. So I thought this was a match made in heaven, and we got it. This is the first festival ever showing it. Its first red carpet premiere, because they canceled everything else after the Las Vegas situation. They didn't want to do premieres. So this is it.
This is it. The movie Marshall will be the opening. It's premiering tomorrow night.
With
the entire cast, the red carpet. Chicago International Film Festival starts tomorrow, runs through the 26th. Founder and CEO of the parent company, Michael Kutza, in studio tonight. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back, and I want to get into those pump room days. That's where we're going next. Michael Kutza in studio. Stay with us.
Oh, probably some.
You don't know who that is?
For that.
Yeah. I'm assuming. I don't know. We'll watch the news and that right about now, right?
We honored Walt Disney and Mickey Mouse. Mickey Mouse on whatever birthday. God, it was remarkable. And Disney's people took an entire train, with Mickey Mouse from L.A. because Walt loved trains. And that train came Union Station, marching bands. We did the cake cutting with Mayor Bilandic then at the top of that executive building over there. Remarkable. And Mickey Mouse, of course, not allowed to speak, but I learned later who Mickey Mouse was in that costume.
Michael Kutza is my guest in studio. He is the longtime founder, longtime artistic director, now CEO, Chicago International Film Festival, which
long
starts
time
tomorrow.
Means old, I guess, right? Long
well,
time?
It's, I mean, the 53rd annual Chicago International Film Festival. Take us back to 1964. What are you, 22, 23 years old? I've read it two different ways. It's 22.
And it all started with a silent actress named Colleen Moore. She had retired in Chicago. She was the highest paid female in the movies back then. And Irv Kupp's in it. I made a little film, and I said, Kupp, I made this film. I won an award, and I want to start this film festival thing. I want Chicago to see all these films. And Kupp said, you know, Mike, nobody calls me Mike, you got to meet this lady. Her husband's dead, and it's time that she gets over this widow thing, and you're the perfect thing to do it. bring her back into her days in Hollywood. She married the president, Merrill Lynch, and she lived in Chicago, became a society lady. I met her, and she became like my second mother, which my present mother was not very happy about, but, you know, you move on.
What did she teach you? I mean, what was that relationship like?
Well, let's not go that far, but I was just like the kid down the block with all these wild ideas, and she said, okay, first of all, you're too young, so we're going to change your age, and I'm going to give you a pair of glasses, which she got from Harold Lloyd, another silent film star, and you're going to wear these glasses, and you're going to be 27. I was 27 for 7 years. I got to the point where I never knew how old I really was. And she said, so let's start this thing. You get the films, and I'm going to get you the stars, and we're going to make this thing happen because I'm really bored. That's really came down to it.
Well, at the time, and like take us to the mid-60s. I mean, what was the film festival circuit like at that time? Where would you go, and how would you get stars to come to Chicago?
I want to go one step further about Colleen, because Colleen lived at 1320 North State Parkway across the street from the Pump Room.
Of course, yeah.
So Colleen, since she was a silent film comedian, like Charlie Chaplin, but a woman, and she says, well, you know, I got Joan Crawford coming over today, and Myrna Loy is here for lunch. I'm meeting all these people, and it really didn't dawn on me what I was involved with, and it was all sort of happening fast, and I said, okay. And we all had, besides lunch at her house, we would go to the Pump Room across the street, because that's where they all hung out for lunch. Because in those days, in the days of movies, even before jet planes, you took the 20th century from New York, the train stopped in Chicago, you stayed at the Ambassador, east or west, because the hotels were there, and connected by a tunnel. You had lunch or breakfast at the Pump Room, and you took the train the next day to California. So this is the stopping point. It's ironic that the Pump Room is now opening again, called Booth One, hotel is just renamed again, the Ambassador.
I mean, it's such a great Chicago story.
The circle is happening. The cycle.
Everyone knows Cup at the Pump Room, and the story's there. But, I mean, at that point, and I have to ask because
The hotel was owned. This is the other. It was owned by Mervyn LeRoy's wife, another major Hollywood director of Colleen. So this all started to happen, and we all became friends for the rest of our life until they all, you know,
Michael,
moved on.
Were you setting out to have this kind of connection when you said, I want to do
no
a film festival?
I had no idea where this was going. All I wanted to do was bring these foreign films to Chicago, do this festival, and change the way Chicago saw movies. I wanted them to see what I saw.
What was your... I mean, when you began your interest in doing a film festival and bringing foreign films to Chicago, what was the thought about foreign films? You mentioned the only thing Americans knew at that time were French films, but you really had a love of cinema from all over.
But because I actually made a little movie and I started showing it in festivals, and I went to festivals, and Colleen and I went to Cannes. That was the big first thing I ever saw was the Cannes Film Festival, and that made me think, okay, we can do that here. In my day, we only had a foreign film theater down on Michigan Avenue called the Fine Arts in the World Playhouse, a little thing on Michigan and Chicago Avenue called the Cinema. But they all showed like one movie. They showed an Italian movie or one French film. That was it. Or a Swedish film. That's all you saw for 6 months. And then I realized there's a whole world of stuff out there. And let's bring it here and let's change Chicago.
When you started showing this in successive years in 66, 67,
nobody
68,
came.
Nobody came.
Yeah, nobody came. How'd you know that?
I didn't. You finished the sentence.
Nobody came. Nobody came.
But really, I mean, talk about building that audience, because nobody did come.
That's right. Also, we were in November. It's always with snow. It's difficult to get people to come here.
Well, as a young, fledgling filmmaker, but also someone who wants to start a festival, was there a time, and I know that, I mean, I think it was 1967, that you said, enough of this. I want to fold this. Never.
I went to Mayor Daley, the real Mayor Daley. And I said, I'm doing this thing, and I need your help. He was absolutely a fascinating man, and I didn't even know what to make of me. Yeah, uh-huh, yeah. I need a theater, I need hotels, I need things to make this really work. I'll give you McCormick Place. I said, I don't really want McCormick Place. I'll give you McCormick Place. I'll give you the hotels, but I want my name on anything. I said, okay. He said, the films you show are dangerous to me. I can lose votes. Don't put my name on it, but I will help you all the way, which he did. And he gave me a guy named Frank Sullivan, who did all his PR, did everything at City Hall. And we also helped start the film office because he wanted films to come here. I said, we will promote making movies in Chicago and everything we do at the film festival around the world. Really strange how this all starts.
Was that how was that the change of getting audiences in when the city got on board and Frank started to help you and Mayor Daley silently helped you?
More visible and we were able to get. I tried the McCormick Place thing for 1 year. I said, this isn't going to work. And then we started looking at the Granada Theater. All these places are gone, of course, now. And the Biograph Theater and.
Carnegie was at the beginning of the festival.
Carnegie was the first festival.
These are great. I mean, there's a lot of listeners right now who are probably going down memory lane thinking of
and
the names
Carnegie Theater things. Right now is your Hugo's Frog Bar. That's exactly where it was.
Michael Kutz is in studio with me tonight. He's the founder of the Chicago International Film Festival. The 53rd annual festival begins tomorrow here in Chicago. And we're talking about its early days here on the download. It is interesting because, you know, as you get later into the 60s, into the 70s, you do notice that America's palette changes. More and more interest in what's happening around the world, more and more interest in foreign films. How did the festival change as society changed? More people interested in learning about film and art and culture from other places in the world?
I'll give you that answer, but I want to complete a thought because as the festival grew back in those early years, film directors started to hear about us and they wanted to come to Chicago. Why? Because they had heard of Al Capone and Mayor Daley. These are two fascinating things. Then they came here and they fell in love with the look of the city and they wanted to make movies here. Then we'll go back to what you just asked.
Okay. Yeah. As you really did double down on showing foreign films, did it help that society was changing its mind towards looking at the rest of the world and there was a counterculture movement and people wanted more or more interested in what was being produced around the world?
Thanks to people like Haskell Wexler and documentaries, yeah. Absolutely, Chicago is changing and we helped change it. And that also backfired with my relationship with Mayor Daley because Haskell made Medium Cool.
Of course, in 1968, right?
And then Daley stopped, all filmmaking must stop here until I read all scripts.
Really?
So that was, he put a stop to all filmmaking. Yeah, Haskell.
And all of Chicago, he said,
No one could make a film here again until the script was cleared after
because
Haskell.
Because that Medium Cool, of course, it was a fascinating, groundbreaking
show.
It was inside the 1968 Democratic Convention protests. If you watch that film, that is an amazing film.
It has the great shoot to kill line, and it has Daley saying it, and it has the convention. It's remarkable.
And after that, he said, I have to read the scripts if you want to shoot here.
Which took a while, a couple of years, and then all that went away. And Haskell became a long supporter of the festival until I think he died last year. Great guy.
Michael Kutza in studio tonight. We're talking about the Chicago International Film Festival, which begins tomorrow. Let's take a break. We'll get an update on tonight's news.
Some new things, though.
Yeah, and
old stuff. Come on.
You know me, man. I want to stay on the old stuff. Stories about Mayor Daley. I have a grin ear to ear right now talking about Chicago history with Michael Kutza. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll get an update on tonight's news, and we'll continue the conversation here on The Download. Stay with us. It's a download here at 720 WGN. Thanks, Rob. Michael Kutz is in studio. He is the longtime artistic director, founder of the Chicago International Film Festival, which begins tomorrow, runs through October 26th. The film Marshall opens the festival tomorrow night. Red carpet, the whole bit. Michael Kutz in studio talking about the history of the festival and what to expect from this year. But, I mean, just great stories about Chicago moving from, you know, sort of being a tried and true old school kind of city and moving into industries it's unfamiliar with.
And we were doing the Daley thing earlier before we cut off by the free windows. the one who fell in love, the mayor who fell in love with the film festival was Jane Byrne. And she saw all the potential. She saw everything.
Jane Byrne, she comes in and she understands what a film festival
can
do.
And her team, her whole team did. And, okay, we're going to fund this. We're going to do this, that, the other, and we'll promote it. And it was fantastic. She really understood.
Does the film festival, Chicago International Film Festival, does it work hand in hand with the film industry coming to Chicago to shoot film? I mean, is it all one part of it? I mean, how much, I guess, sway does a film festival have in trying to get films to be shot here in Chicago?
I think those days are over because right now Chicago is the center of television. The actual feature films, they may come in for 2 days, 3 days. It's not like it used to be. It's expensive to shoot here. The weather is totally uncontrollable. Right, yeah, right, you don't know where it's going. And you need a good tax incentive. We have it. But then when am I going to get my money? Because the state is a little awkward and paying off. If you can't pay your lottery, it's awfully difficult to give me the percentage for my movie, too. And I hear this from filmmakers. So television is working very well here. Right. And do we help? We're really not in that business to help. We were. We were very much instrumental in getting movies here, but not anymore.
When you were instrumental, what was the pitch? I mean, would you say, hey, we got this great film festival, Vavil's got this great town, you should come to town?
Anything we did, we promoted, make a movie, get involved with the film office. We were part of the package. Yeah. When a director came, we would try to sell them on making a movie here.
You know,
it just became natural to do it.
As we move on from Jane Byrne into more of the modern time of film festivals, and we think about,
I'll tell you something funny. Okay. Since we're before Sundance and before Montreal and before Toronto, as we became very visible, I had a young man come here. Well, I just started Toronto, and it's a couple years old, and we've been studying what you're doing and how visible you are. Would you come work for us? I said, no, like a fool. I was just a kid. I'm still just a kid. Then Montreal came. Others came. So the irony of that story was, no, I was going to continue making this thing work. But it was sort of fun when we were so visible. They came to Chicago.
They came to you.
See what we did that was working so well and so visible.
I mean, I think about all those film festivals you mentioned, Toronto, Cannes, Sundance. I mean, there's so many different film festivals. The experience, especially here in North America, has become almost turbo. In the way that now there's a pipeline, we know when the festivals are going to show and what the next move is to go to the Oscars. I mean, it's almost become cookie cutter and formulaic. I mean, have you noticed a change in the way that film festivals interact with Hollywood and how it has become a much bigger industry?
Of course. But even though people say, well, festivals are over and blah, 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 Netflix, et cetera, it's not true. We are a complete niche. The only way you're going to see the films we show are with us. And you're going to see with the director or actors or stars with us. So you're coming to the festival. You're not just going to see a movie. You're going to see a movie you're not going to be able to see maybe ever again or maybe next year on Netflix or next season or something. It's still that niche that is impossible to get anywhere else. I think that's what keeps us strong.
And
and Oscars, yes, some people spin us off. Of course, Marshall wants to spin off into getting an Oscar.
Right. Well, La La Land was the opening film last year. You do have this.
I really hated that guy. I said, I love your film. I really hate you because you're 31 years old. You've made two movies, and this thing is, your Whiplash is pretty terrific.
That's
and
a
this
great,
is your
yeah.
second film. I hate you.
I hate you.
He's funny.
Well, I mean, does it change the way you approach your festival? When you know now that you definitely have to compete with streaming sites or you know that you have to compete with other festivals, that you know that there's a pipeline and even the audience has become more sophisticated?
We work very closely with all the festivals.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Because when Mimi and I and our team will find a film that we like in Cannes or Berlin or something, and you put your mark on it that you want it, we're October. That was already February. By then, it's going to go through distribution and sales, et cetera, et cetera. You may lose it to theatrical or to a Netflix or HBO or Amazon or something. It's a long haul. You found it. You want it. It may then go to Telluride, New York, and Toronto, and then Chicago, even though you found it first. It's just the progression of things and the cycle of where we are in the calendar, too. But still, we're coming to a market that is pretty far away from those other places. We're for Chicago.
Speaking of calendar, I mean, we talked about this right at the beginning of the interview, the idea that your work is year-round. You're going to festival after festival, watching movie after movie. The film festival in the last couple of years has expanded to the way that now it's events. I mean, I was trying to get you in here for the Jane Fonda event that was a couple weeks ago and the others that were earlier in the season.
We did Helen Mirren in April. We are year-round with so many events. And Jane, we did Jane in July. And now we have Patrick Stewart and Vanessa here in October and Michael Shannon. You have to keep going in that sense. So this festival closes. We have a television festival, for instance, in March. Then we have educational screenings every month with Chicago Board of Education. We have 7,000 kids a year we take to the movies for free. And then in May, we do a thing called Cine Youth, which are young filmmakers age 22 down, up to 6 to 22, let's say. So you make us a movie. And we showed in this specialized festival. You talk about talented kids, but I really hate these guys. I think we gave an award to some 8-year-old one here, and I really resented him.
Yeah, I...
And besides that, okay, we do free screenings at the Cultural Center from May through October of international cinema. So we are year-round. That's what Cinema Chicago is, the year-round organization. The festival is only this two-week thing in October, which is pretty spectacular.
And, but, it, I mean, it is the crown jewel in the 53rd annual. Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is when all the films are coming in and the stars are out. But, I mean, for you as a guy who put this film festival together with, what, 7 to 10 films in 1964...
That's true.
And I think your quote is that two were good, I guess, something like that. But from that to where you're at now, to going year round and all of this exposure and all these programs, I mean, is it hard for you to imagine the scope in the way that it's changed from how you started to where you're at now?
I would never think of that. You just brought that back up to hurt me.
Not to hurt you. I think it's reflective, right? I mean, I think back when you were 22 years old, geez, man, we're doing, I mean, you're such an integral part of the city of Chicago's film.
In 66, we showed Bill Friedkin's first film, a documentary. I reminded him of that the other day, saying, you should come back to Chicago. Yeah, Mike. I always know how close they are when they say Mike, you know? Bill, you got a new film. Let's do it. Well, I want to come in. I don't want to come to all those people. Maybe in November I'll come do something. You want to do something in November? I said, maybe.
I mean, it's interesting because throughout the interview you've talked about relationships.
Very important.
They're important. And you think about young filmmakers as they set out and they get a chance to go out and make their independent film, but also get an opportunity to work in Hollywood. How important is it to...
Joe Swanberg. Joe, mm-hmm. Chicago product.
Been on the show a couple
right
times,
now.
Yeah.
So who's Joe Swanberg? He worked in our office doing travel for us. He'd fly you in as a director, and he'd work out all the travel. And he also met his future wife at our festival.
Another great filmmaker.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And we've helped his career, and he's coming back this year to work with the festival and be a guest speaker in our industry days things. Mark Romanek, another director from, worked in our mailroom.
Is it important for you to have this connection to young filmmakers from Chicago? I mean,
absolutely. They're your future. So... when we have a first film director back then, when they make their fifth film, they'll give you a call, or their sixth, and it's like a family. They come back because they have this loyalty, and that's a wonderful feeling that develops.
You know,
in fact, Mimi pointed out, our new artistic director, pointed out, Michael, she said, she knows me better than Mike, and she said, you know, we have a father... I think it was from Poland, with his film. And you know, his daughter has a new film we're showing in another section of the festival. It's wonderful. I said, you're joking. I said, no, I bet you didn't know that. I did not know that. I was very excited that talk about a family and years with the history of the festival.
When you go out and you go to Hollywood and you go to different festivals, specifically Hollywood, how has that industry changed? I mean, for you to have been out there now decade after decade after decade to scope out the new work,
well, when we go to Hollywood, we only scope out the studio films, which are lesser and lesser as the studios start to wind down.
Is that the big difference, that they're winding down?
Well, they can't really make it much more, and that's why the Amazons are popping up and the Netflixes are popping up. Is that a plural, Netflixes, you think?
I think so.
The studios cannot continue to make endless tent poles, as they call them, you know. The Star Wars, of course, they'll keep doing. But look at Transformers.
Well,
died.
I mean,
you know, these things are over.
Yeah, and it's interesting too, because I know we have coming up on the show a Netflix film, you know, stuff that goes straight to Amazon, or you know, other people who've done stuff that just go right to almost like specials, movies that are just for the streaming sites. Well, they don't necessarily need the film festivals. They don't need distribution. They go straight to these streams.
But they do. We visit them and Amazon and HBO and all, And yes, they will have a specialized film that they feel is more important, that they've made. They may test it theatrically with us, then go stream a couple of weeks later. They still feel they want to get certain demos that we have, I'd say, in Cannes this year. I think the new Woody Allen film was paid for by Amazon, I believe. Right. Or Netflix. I'm not remember which.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, it's quite common to...
To be able to be in the festival and then go to stream.
If they see it marketing-wise as a useful tool, yeah, we're still out there. As I say, we are a niche, that a strong niche, the film festival.
53rd annual.
We never use annuals. 53rd Chicago International Film Festival. Okay, 53rd. Annuals are weird.
Yeah, all right. Well, 53rd straight year of the Chicago International Film Festival. You know, as we wrap up here, it's rare that you'll see an institution like the Chicago International Film Festival, retain the same talent that runs it. In your case, you're the founder, artistic director. You just stepped aside as artistic director, but you're still CEO. 53 years of doing this year after year. Talk about that. I mean, just give us a parting thought on this.
You become the mentor. I have no problem becoming the great sage for my staff and my kids that work with. They're my kids. They truly are family. And I think they see it. They enjoy it. They've all grown with it. They grow on to go to their next jobs, whether it's in the industry or not. I think you become a teacher. And I think those that stay and those that move on, they enjoy the meeting the directors, seeing the films, and the knowledge that goes with it.
Chicago, it's been a big part of your – grew up here, grew up in the West Side.
West Side, yeah. Austin.
You had this, we've talked about the days of the Pump Room and everything that started your festival when you're 22 years old, your relationship with Roger Ebert as well. We didn't even get into that, but a great relationship. I mean, talk about how important it is to be a Chicagoan who runs the Chicago International Film Festival. What does Chicago mean to you?
Chicago is my home. Chicago, my roots. The West Side was very important. But I've been living in Old Town for 50 years now, and the downtown is more important, and watching the audiences grow, young audiences grow, and our usual demo. I say demos a lot because we all study who comes. I mean, you want to get a younger crowd, and that's why you have Patrick Stewart this year.
Right,
he may be old, but who's going to be at that audience? 20-year-olds,
people like Family Guy and those kind of shows.
And Michael Shannon, young crowd. Even Marshall, the opening, a young crowd. You got to skew your audiences now. Chicago. I've watched Chicago change. I've watched other film organizations develop, spun off of ours. And it's great. It gives you a great feeling just to watch my city.
Michael Kutza is the founder.
I'm not running for mayor.
And mayoral candidate.
I have no intention.
It's the mayor of film, the mayor of the Chicago International Film Festival.
Thanks for having me tonight.
Great to have you. The 53rd Chicago International Film Festival starts tomorrow night with the highly anticipated film Marshall. Continues to the 26th. You can find all the information at the website and, of course, all over as it gets great coverage from the newspapers.
What's the website?
Well, the Chicago
Filmfestival.com.
Filmfestival.com.
Did I hear that? That's right.
At this point, it's just as Matt in the segment before said, can I give the website? People just put it in. You just put it in the search bar. Chicago International Film Festival, and you're on your way. You don't even need websites anymore.
That's true.
Michael Kutza, great to have you. Thanks for being my guest tonight. Thank you, man. That place is great. I love it. Now that I read that, I feel I have so much more warmth and heart. You know, when you've not been to a place and have to read the Ishinala Supper Club spot, I'd be like, well, this is a supper club. Madison Magazine likes it. Now I've been there, I'm like, yo, oh, you're the right. Yeah, we got to go. Pete will go. It'll be fun. All right. Coming up, Greg Flam, 312-981-7200 to swap meet. We're going to evaluate our collectibles, our memorabilia. Hopefully some people have some Pump Room, Mayor Daley, Jane Byrne. I love it. I absolutely love it. Michael Kutza, that was fun. The story that sticks with me from that interview is that after Haskell Wexler does The Medium Cool, which if you have not seen that film, that is a great film, but it was not very flattering to the mayor. The mayor's like, no one can shoot here in Chicago any longer until I read the script. I just had this visual of the old man sitting in his Bridgeport recliner being like, don't bother me. I got to read these scripts. They want to do an action film on Wacker. I don't understand these stage directions. Everyone, all the kids, like all the dailies. Dad, can we get a story? No, I don't have time. I got to read this Beretta script. Dustin Hoffman wants a shoot here. I got to read this. I'll read you right now. I'll read you The Graduate. Whatever shot here.
Oh, too funny.
I mean, really. I mean, it kind of makes you want to do like Mayor Daly's stage readings. Like screenplays read by Mayor Daly. The old Mayor Daly. But read from his son. We get his son to actually do it. New Mayor Daly. That's how you got it. If you're from Chicago, it's, you know, they like to do the initials, but I think it's better to say Old Daly and New Daly. It's a better way to do it. All right, Greg Flamm coming up here. We're going to do Swap Meet, 312-981-7200. Stay with us.
It's time for Swap Meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Or it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman.
And Greg Flamm.
Here we are.
That's right. It's time for the Swap Meet, 312-981-7200, right here on 720 WGN. Exciting Wednesday night, one of my favorite segments. Always a pleasure to have Greg Flamm at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter, in studio tonight to evaluate our collectibles, our memorabilia, the things we hold sacred, the things we move with. That's what.
Yep. Right? Just can't part with it.
You can't part with. There's a lot of stuff you like that goes in the trash.
Well, you'll pack it, you'll put it in storage, you'll pay for the storage for it and everything. So
I've been in a lot of trouble this week.
Okay.
Because my wife was mad because at the end of last year, when we took down Halloween decorations, I broke her favorite ghost that lit up in the yard, right?
Okay.
And so every time we went to Target to get new ghosts, but they're different shapes.
Okay.
So all I get, Greg, is, no, these aren't as good as the old ghosts.
Oh, of course.
were
they the old-fashioned blow molds type,
no,
or it was like a newer
kind? They were kind of a newer one, but the point being that, I mean, yeah.
No, you broke her favorite
I broke
Halloween
the
ornament.
Or from a year old.
Right.
I mean, come on. But my point being that, like, yeah, these are the kind of things that I need to take I have to do better at approaching how I store and care for the things that are going to be brought back. Because when I put stuff in a box, I'm like,
if you have a picture, send it to me. I'll keep an eye out for you.
There you go. I'm looking for the bigger ones.
I'll be your picker for you.
I love it. 312-981-7200. All right, Greg, as every week, you bring some goodies in studio to kind of kick us off. What do you got tonight?
Well, the big one was World War II medals I found. And and this is the first time in 3 years I found them. They're usually the first thing that sells. But I happened to come across a garage sale. And the son and the grandson of the deceased veteran were fine with selling them. I normally don't even ask to buy them, but when I had a chance, I jumped on it. I probably paid about $20, and they're worth about $100 to $200, somewhere in there.
Wow,
so we'll see.
Nothing
really high end. They're nothing like Purple Heart, but they're mostly good conduct, which is kind of common.
Attendance.
Then there was the European, Middle East, African campaign medal, and then there's American campaign medal.
Wow.
And then there's a rifle, smaller medal. But, yeah, the lot of them should be more than $100, I would think.
Do you see more and more now when you talk about decorations from World War II, or even the Korean War, Vietnam? Do you see those actually going for bigger prices online because of just the fact that they were from
anything war, and obviously now Vietnam and even Gulf War memorabilia is gone up. The medals that you kind of want to look for, if they have the person's name engraved on the back, it's worth a little bit more. So that's one thing to look for. And one of these, the good conduct one, has his name engraved on the back.
I won't
say whose name it is. But yeah, I couldn't pronounce the name. But and then I brought a 1947 Dick Tracy double record.
Oh,
and this is really cool.
Look at that thing.
Yeah, and this is like some heavy-duty vinyl in here. The vinyl's like a quarter inch thick.
Oh, it's like the thick vinyl.
Yeah. And there's two, records in here. And then it was kind of like you could write in. It was kind of, I guess what they call it here,
what do they call it? Listen to the record, write the story, and color the comic. So as you're listening to the record, you could write the dialogue in the balloons, and then you could color the comic.
So they have a comic strip that's pretty much 75% done. You just need to fill in the balloons.
And you can write in the dialogue. Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, it's kind of cool for 1947, yeah. And it's... Yeah. In this condition, this is probably $30, but they do go...
$30? I think they'd be like $150.
Yeah, there are some that are $50 to $70 in better shape online, but mine are really scratched up.
Like
and anyway, so then, right. And the last thing...
This is what Rob Martyr already called out. He's right. Looking at it. This is a big poster.
Does Rob know where these came from? Yeah, he's not in there. But 1976, Burger King commissioned Neumann to do these bicentennial, giveaways at Burger King where they were like a dollar each or something. But I found three of them at a garage sale, and they're not huge. They can be $25 each, and I probably got all three for a dollar.
This basketball is like a neon.
So this is Olympic basketball, and this poster is dated 76, so that's pre-pro Olympic basketball. The other one I have is swimming and gymnastics.
And so they're Olympics, and they're done in the colorful style of a
mosaic,
who's the artist again?
I guess Neumann. We get a lot of calls for his stuff, so that's why I thought I'd bring one in. And, I mean, that one is probably a $15 poster, nothing crazy. But I just thought I'd bring it in because we've had calls.
And my favorite part about it is got a couple of the tack holes in the corners.
Yeah, they used that ticky-tack stuff on the back of it. And also, to give a character, it looks like it's been kind of corroding from some, bugs eating away at the paper at the bottom. So, yeah, this always makes it interesting.
When I pull out... one of these days I'm going to go up to, like I said, to do my mystery.
Bring
box
your whole tub
my,
in, yeah.
The whole tub. It's just going to be a bunch of bugs ate everything in it because it's in a pole barn in Wisconsin. But it'll be like I remember I saved like newspaper clippings. I think I have like the Bill Clinton impeached.
Yeah.
You know, is that worth anything? Like one of the papers that says president impeached?
Yeah, I would guess not because some of the, Kennedy era and things like that aren't even worth that much anymore. So,
but, I mean, it was Monica Lewinsky. I mean, it's... No?
Right. Yeah, right. Maybe. Right. The blue dress, red dress, red dress.
Sure. 312-981-7200. Greg Flam is in studio. We're evaluating your collectibles, your memorabilia, your junk. What do you want to talk about tonight? Let's start with Judy. Judy, what do you want to brag about, Judy?
Well, I don't know if I want to brag about it. I just want an idea about what it's worth. My ex-husband had bought me, I believe, during the Gulf War, and it's still a 52 card or whatever, sealed, never opened, of some of the players, a lot of the players, like Saddam Hussein.
Right, yeah, Gulf War, what do they call that? Desert Storm cards, I think they were called.
What do you mean players? Like
They were like playing cards, but they had, like the Ace of Spades, I think, was Saddam Hussein or something like that. And they would kind of rank the bad guys of the war, in the cards. And I don't know if they had U.S. personnel on the cards as well. I don't recall. Do you know offhand?
They had Schwarzkopf on it.
Okay. Yeah. Then there must have been a couple different sets like that.
King of Hearts.
The self thing is still unbroken.
So it's sealed.
Yeah, still sealed, right?
What is that worth? That's an interesting item. I like that. That's a souvenir. It's relevant. It's historic, and it's a little bit gross. It's got all the things.
Yep.
Making a game of war, as we like to do in this country. What do you think, Greg?
Okay, so we have, I did find the two different sets. There was the most wanted, Iraqi most wanted U.S. military playing cards, and then there was the Desert Storm playing cards. And they're anywhere from $5 to $10. I'm trying to find a sealed pack to see if that makes a difference. Yeah, probably about $25 sealed. It looks like
that's not worth it. Crack those open, play some pinochle.
Right, save it for rainy day.
Right,
I'll keep it in the box, and maybe the great grandchildren.
There you go.
With the beanie babies, yeah,
or blackjack. I'm just saying. Right. I'm just saying, Judy. Right. All right, thanks.
Right up.
There you go.
Thanks for calling.
312-981-7200. We'll take a quick break. Greg Flam at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter, in studio, ready to evaluate your collectibles. What you move with. 312-981-7200. Stay with us. It's
It's the Swap Meet here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. 312-981-7200. Text or call in with what you'd like to brag about. It could be anything from, what did they say, a cellophane wrapped Desert Storm cards pack
right.
of cards.
Yep.
Or my favorite, the T-shirts, all the rock T-shirts from last week.
Yeah, that was a good one.
And you told me last week that my Yo! MTV Raps T-shirt that I've had since I was in high school was actually worth something.
It is.
And I was so excited, and I went home, and I can't find it.
Isn't that it?
Greg Flam at DuPage Picker, both on Twitter and Facebook, is in studio tonight.
A nice dinner with your wife to make up for that Halloween ornament.
That's like every night we're on the show and I'll be like, I've got this great thing. And be like, oh, that's worth something. I come home like, yes. And I'm like, oh, did I throw that out?
Yeah.
I think I threw that out. All right. 815's got a question here. What's a Dan Hampton football card? Tops.
Tops.
Tops Dan Hampton football card, 1985. Also, first issue Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles comic book. But first, Dan Hampton Tops, 1985. Just Dan Hampton's card?
1981, they said?
85.
Oh, 85. Okay.
Yeah, the 81 Bears. Remember that juggernaut? No, the 85 Bears. Come on.
Oh, I just found an 81 card from
really?
It. Really?
So, yeah. That's probably his rookie
year. Is that
his
rookie? Yeah. And that's usually the higher one, the rookie ones. Let's see. I'd say $10 to $15.
Hall of Famer.
Yeah.
All right, how about the first issue of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles comic book?
Yeah, that's a little harder to find because there were so many different ones.
Is the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, is that a Marvel or a DC product? Like, I always get confused where they fit in the canon of comic books because I know movies were made and there was cartoons made that we watched on TV, but I always just thought they kind of made that up. But it seems to me more I learned mostly through this program that there was actually a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle movement.
Yeah, I look for anything Teenage Mutant Ninja, especially the earlier stuff. I don't know if they came through Nickelodeon to begin with or they picked them up, but I don't know how they started, to be honest. But
there's no like 1961 Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yeah, I don't know when.
The blob kind of thing.
Yeah, I don't know how the origins. I'm not a big comic book guy to begin with. But but I still look for their stuff, especially the early, 80s, 90s stuff can be worth quite a bit. And so I'm trying to find the comic book now and see the first maybe.
312-981-7200 is the phone number and the text line. We got a lot coming in, but I want to get to Pete Zimmerman because he's got over a weekend he had put his name in for some evaluation. Pete, you're an antique. I didn't take you for an antiquer.
I go out and do some shopping every now and again to see if I can find some deals.
Are you a kind of a deal guy who tries to go find the good stuff, the diamond in the rough, or are you the guy that goes to the high end antique store in one of the boutique neighborhoods of Chicago that's charging $600 for something they found for $10.
You know, I usually just follow my wife into the store and then I say, where are the records? And I go flip through those for any old Captain and Tennille stuff.
Nice.
But I was in this, we went to Michigan to a couple of antique shops over the weekend, and they had this one shop had this kind of a long flag.
Okay.
With all the CTA bus line, the Chicago bus lines, like the 22 Clark bus, whoosh, across, down, like the 151 Sheridan bus.
So, like, it would have been standing, would it have been?
Like, I don't know if it was on a pole
like
or
maybe
something.
Maybe it was like the way they did things back in the 50s or 60s when it came to buses. It was more like flags on a pole as opposed
to. Yeah, like maybe in a station they had, it was a banner that was hanging somewhere. It was really cool. It had, 10 or 15 bus lines on it. They had a price for $8.99.
$8.99?
No, $899.
Ooh,
wow.
That's a score.
It's a little steep.
Yeah, so how do you, of course you bought it. So how did you?
And I really want it. Yeah. And
what do you want to go back there this weekend and be like, talk to Greg and he's $400?
Because I went to eBay afterwards. I'm like, let me see if I can find something. And if there's similar ones for like $100, but not, I don't know, this didn't look like really as cool.
And the best part is that someone will buy it for $8.99 in Michigan, bring it to one of these boutique neighborhoods in Chicago, and they'll be like, it's $2,600.
Yeah.
And you'll be like, ugh. And there is the racket.
Yeah, I'm not finding any other than there's some like London, you know, bus stop flags, but I'm not finding
tube flags.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really long. It's, you know, it's probably like 12 feet long with, you know, I don't think it had every bus route, but, you know, just the Chicago Grand, you know, all the street, you know, all the city streets. It was just like the Wilson to Shane. I don't know. It was just like really cool looking. It was that black is. With white letters.
If you got it, were you the kind of guy that could
oh, yeah,
picture where you're going to put it?
Yeah, we have a spot for it. Yeah.
Oh.
Wow.
But send me the specs. I'll make it for you. That's what my dad would say. He would say, oh, I found a cool chair. Show me. Send me a picture. I'll make it for you.
Yep.
All right. Thanks.
Yeah, that's my parents, too. Like, anytime I wanted something, they would, you know, I want the, you know, the new hot new BMX bike, and they get the Huffy, you know, like, no, this is not working.
When we were looking at furniture when our son was born, we were wanting to get, like, a toy box or this, that, and the other. And my dad was, I mean, he's good. He's great with his hands and woodwork, but it was so funny. You'd always be like, this is what you're looking at? I'll make it for you.
Every parent's that way. If you recall the Eddie Murphy skit on the Big Mac, and the mom's like, I'll make you a Big Mac. Let's go home. Get, you know. So that's always the way it is.
Greg Flam in studio at DuPage Picker, both Facebook and Twitter, 312-981-7200. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back, get Rob's news, and then we'll do second half of the swap meet, so stay with us.
It's time for swap meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman
and Greg Flam.
Let's do this.
Let's do it. 312-981-7200 to Swap Meets, where we talk about your collectibles, find out how much they're worth, what you want to brag about, all that jazz. Like I said, 312-981-7200. Greg Flam in studio. Let's get the second half started with Cynthia. Cynthia, what do you want to brag about?
I have a cookbook written by Mary and Vincent Price. And I was wondering the value of it.
Awesome.
It was copyrighted in 1965. It doesn't say there were any other printings. This one says 1978 printing. And it's leather bound, bronze colored leather with gold leaf.
Yes, they
What are some of the recipes in there? Is it like all like, are we talking Vincent Price, like ghouls and goblins type stuff?
No. This is from all over the world. France, Italy, Holland, all his favorite places to go. Scandinavia.
So he's just like, this is what I like to eat?
tons of places. United States, Chicago, New York, the Santa Fe Chief. Years ago when they had trains, you know, they had dining cars.
Cynthia, I thought it would be more like... here's how you make it seem like you're touching eyeballs. They're not eyeballs. Peeled grapes.
This is, this is really, truly serious. Cooking was his hobby, so it was his wife as well.
Right. Well, the book you're talking about has gone for as high as $120, and as you know, as low as $40. I see one here $25 as well. But there was another higher price, Vincent Price.
This is the one with the spaghetti and the guts, right?
No, this one was, it says Corgi Cookbook, 1971, first edition. That one went for $185.
Yeah. Okay, that one I don't have. Yeah. I've had this one for 39 years.
Right, but you described the $120 one.
There you go.
Okay.
All right, thanks, Cynthia.
I also have 14 baseball cards. They're Tops. Okay.
Okay.
And two of them are Yankees double cards. They're 1967 rookie stars, Stan Benson, Bobby Mercer, Pat Dobson, George Cornish. Okay. And then the other ones are like Tommy Sisk, Eddie Stanky, Jim Stewart of the Cubs. Stanky was White Sox. Tommy Sisk was the Pirates.
Okay.
George Altman of the Cubs.
All right.
Jose Santiago of the Red Sox. Mike Kuehler, pitcher of the Astros.
Okay.
Petrucelli, Red Sox.
Some random players here.
Well, obviously, there's way too much for me to get prices for you on that.
Thanks,
I'm just trying to get 1967 Yankee cards.
I just like that there's like 14 randos.
Yeah.
It's not like she even collected them. She just was like, I found
I mean, just some random Yankees or Topps cards from that year are, you know, between $5 and $30, unless you have some, you know, really signed one.
Cindy,
or...
I'd go find some Aaron Judge and Gary Sanchez cards because they're about to beat the Indians in the Game 5 of the ALDS. But all right, Pat, what do you want to brag about, Pat?
Hi.
Hi.
I've inherited a scrapbook, and it is full of World War One postcards,
okay,
written mostly in French, showing destruction in France and in Germany.
Wow.
Yeah, I know.
Well, before I knew about the France part, regular ones were about $10 each.
Yes.
And, you know, while Justin takes over here, I'm going to try to get you a price on the France ones.
Ooh, very exciting, though. I like the World War One cards. You know what movie I just saw was the film Goodbye, Christopher Robin, which is there's a lot of World War One action in that film.
Good one.
It's a good film, but it was just a lot of good action. It was like he was kind of flashbacking to his time in World War One. It made me think about that. And Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman had a ton of World War One stuff in it.
True. Do you have any suggestion what I should do with these postcards?
Well, Greg's got that suggestion.
I would. Are you on Facebook, first off?
Yes.
Okay, if you're on Facebook, there is an actual... a Facebook group that deals with postcards, and they would go crazy over your collection. So, if you just punch in vintage postcards in Facebook, you'll see the group.
Yeah.
And there's probably thousands of people on that group that would definitely help you where to evaluate them better, or they'll buy them from you.
There you go.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks, Pat. Mm-hmm. All right. Let's go to John. John, what do you want to brag about, bud?
Hey, how you guys doing? I happened to I had an album, Hard Again, by Muddy Waters, and I had the fortune of having both Muddy Waters and Johnny Winter, obviously both on the album, sign it. Wow. I don't know if James Cotton's also on it. I never got his signature. I always planned to, but sadly he passed away. So I was just wondering if that's worth anything.
Okay.
Muddy Waters signing a record. I would think that would be worth something.
Johnny Winter.
Yeah, and Johnny Winter, too. You're right.
Yep. Let's see.
I don't know. I think that it always goes one way or the other with these guys because, Muddy Waters, you get to a certain point and he probably signs everything. So maybe the stuff goes down in value, but I still would think that the combination would be pretty cool.
Well, they signed Muddy Waters' chess box set. These are CDs, I believe. Went for $70. So add the, Edgar Winter signature, Johnny Winter, rather. Onto that, a good winner.
Edgar Winter 70s. And Muddy Waters would be great.
Right,
a great combo.
And what was the other artist that you didn't get the signature?
James Cotton. He was the harp player, but I kept thinking he would come back to Chicago, but he was in poor health before he passed away. And if I had gotten all three, obviously, it'd been a coup. But just got Johnny and Muddy.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. I have to say, you're in the 200 to 300 range easily with both of them on there.
There you go.
All right.
Well, I would definitely put that in plastic or frame it.
It's in plastic and going to be framed.
Awesome.
All right. There you go, John. Good stuff.
Okay.
Thanks for calling in. All right. 312-981-7200. Well, let's get to some of these texts, right? We've got a 1973. Okay. There's a couple of bikes. 1973 Schwinn, a 16-inch Typhoon. Original owner, scuff on seat where my husband was pushed over by a neighborhood bully.
Wow.
Authentic.
I could not find a one-speed is what they said, right? One-speed?
That's a different one, but this is a 16-inch Typhoon, original owner. It doesn't say if it's a one-speed or not. The other one was a one-speed,
I'm seeing $350, maybe a little bit more.
All right. That's good. 815 says they had a roll of Saddam Hussein toilet paper where it was his face every sheet. Problem is they sent it to their son who used it when he was in Iraq.
Nice. I am seeing $15 to $20 unused.
Unused?
It's still plastic.
That's some answers to the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Yes, they were a cartoon first. The 630 says, how about an early 60s Schwinn men's collegiate bike one speed?
Yeah, that's the one I could not find a one speed. I found 5-speed, 10-speed. And so I really couldn't give you a price. The fact that I couldn't find it makes it.
Yeah, so one speed would just be a bike. Right?
Yep, just a bike.
Just a bike.
Yep, with chain and wheels,
All right. I got some good stuff here. All right, 847 says, I have Bob Hope's cowboy boots, Tony Lama custom cowboy boots with Bob Hope's initials sewn into the boots.
Wow.
In the original box with a cloth cover on each boot, donated by Dolores Hope for an A&E auction 15 years ago, certified to be directly from Bob Hope's personal closet.
Wow.
Bob Hope's cowboy boots.
All right.
That's got to be the best of the month, right? Bob, I've got, what do I got? What do I want to brag about?
Right.
I've got Bob Hope's cowboy boots.
Man, I'm not going to be able to find that, that's for sure.
Oh, man, there should be a whole site to just Bob Hope's just stuff from his closet. Look so up random. Bob Hope's closet.
Bob Hope, anything signed or anything.
I mean, yeah. But the idea that Bob Hope signed a bunch of stuff, even golf clubs, you'd be like, all right, that's fine. But Bob Hope cowboy boots?
Yeah.
Personally like from his closet?
Yeah, they're monogrammed or whatever he said. I don't know. I can't.
See, I want to know if like Bob Hope was really into cowboy boots because it doesn't seem like a cowboy boot kind of guy to me.
Right.
I don't know. He could have been. But the idea that maybe he got them as a gift one time, he's like, I don't want these anymore. Give these away at an auction.
Right.
I mean, a funny joke.
If he wants to send a picture to Facebook, I'll do some more research on it for him.
There you go. I like that one, though.
Yep.
312-981-7200. We'll take our last break. We'll come back. We'll continue. Greg Flamm is here. We're doing the swap meet. 312-981-7200. Stay with us. We're doing a swap meet tonight. I'm Justin Kaufman. Greg Flamm here at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. 773 wants to know, what's a 1991 Wayne Gretzky signed hockey card worth? You don't get too much signed hockey cards.
Right.
Right? Hockey cards weren't like the baseball cards.
Yeah, they don't go normally unless they're signed by Wayne Gretzky, of course. But that one would be about $115.
Wow.
Is what they've sold for, yeah.
Do the Blackhawks, do they do cards like for the new? I mean, sure they do, right?
I think they do.
Patrick
yeah.
Kane and company. What's a Jonathan Toews card kind of go for from like the 2010 season?
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like
right.
that kind of stuff. Like since they're Stanley Cup champs.
Right.
Doesn't seem like they possibly would show up, you know, like as rookie card for Jonathan Toews or rookie card for Patrick Kane.
2010 Patrick Kane card.
Be a Johnny Aduya.
Like, unsigned a dollar.
Really?
Signed, obviously.
Yeah, you know what?
You know, but
forget that. Forget that. What about a cool, like a Marian Hossa? Like, I saw Marian Hossa walking into Paris Club one time, Studio Paris, after they won the thing, and he had the cool, like, Ed Hardy kind of fitted cool shirt with cool cursive writing on it. What's that worth? We don't know what that's worth.
Ed Hardy shirt's probably the best way to find that.
Backwards hat.
Right.
Flat brim. Sure.
Yep.
What about a complete series, 630 wants to know, of the West Wing, unopened. Complete series. That's going to be worth less and less and less, right? Now that there's streaming and the ability to just kind of stockpile that, I would think that that's right up your alley, Pete. I just feel like you have a ton of that stuff.
Yeah, when I moved, I had, you know, thousands of DVDs, you know, the entire West Wing collection. I mean, tons. And then I went to Declutter, which is you can scan it and they give you a certain amount for it or whatever, and then you can send it off. And I'd have, you know, like West Wing, all 10 seasons, I'd scan it, 47 cents. I'm like, what?
What do you have going there? What do you say?
On DVD, the complete set is $54, is kind of the highest. So you're probably between 30 and 54.
There you go.
So,
and Pete, you gotta think.
But the good news is that there's a lot selling, so people are still watching it, or they're still interested in buying it anyway. So,
630 says, "How about an early '60s Martin four-string tenor guitar played in the Rush Street coffee houses?
Wow,
one crack but fixed, tuned and plays great.
Wow. Well,
if I gave my love a cherry,
all right? The Rush Street value part I can't put on it, but as just a guitar, you might be in the 500 to 1200 range.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Does it come with or without the curly mustache
right.
that the guy who was playing?
Right.
You know? Okay. Let's keep going here. We've got not mine, this is Jerry's, and not mine, but a friend in 1980 showed me his eight volume, 4-inch wide match sets of stamp collector binders. One page really stayed with me. A full page, approximately 8x11, of stamps of Shah Pahlavi, the U.S. friendly father of the Shah Pahlavi of the Iran. We're familiar with the late 70s revolution, turned against the U.S. Really curious. Sounds like it could be worth a lot of money.
Hmm.
I don't know.
I'm trying to get a stamp there for you. Yeah, in fact, about $1,000 for that stamp.
$1,000?
Yeah.
There you go, see?
That's what they're asking. I couldn't find a solder quickly.
Right.
Yeah.
847 says, I'm at work, so I can't send you a picture right now of the Bob Hope boots. Please announce or text me when where to send pictures of them. And by the way, Bob Hope wore cowboy boots in several on-the-road pictures.
There you go.
And also in the movie Buttons and Bows. They're moderately worn.
All right.
I think mine is the best brag I've heard tonight. That's, I would say tonight. What are you talking about? You got October on
right,
lock.
Right.
Bob Hope's cowboy boots, moderately worn. Like, I just had in my head, it was like a present that was sent to me. He's like, I don't want those. Get rid of those. Put them in auction.
Right.
But now that they're moderately worn,
right?
I'm curious.
Yeah, I have to say 700 to 1500, but I would sell that for,
I'd be wearing those everywhere I went. I'd be doing this radio show, and they'd be like, why are you waddling? Why are you waddling in here? I'd be like, because I've got Bob Hope's moderately worn cowboy boots on.
Right, monogram.
That's so awesome. That really is the best brag.
Yeah,
you're going to have a hard time beating that one.
That was a good one.
last week, I think we got close to this one, but basketball signed by all the Bulls.
Yeah, if it's team signed, authenticated, $3,700.
What?
Yeah. There aren't that many.
This says it was before Jordan got really famous, but it was Pippen. He said Pippen, Jordan, the other
Scottie. Yeah, the 3,700 was a championship, you know, era ball. Wow.
270 says 1966 first pressing of the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds.
Hmm.
Wouldn't it be nice? Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's Pet Sounds.
Is it? Is.
Wouldn't it be nice? Beach Boys are one of those bands. I have to say that every time I hear a Beach Boys song, I'm like, oh, that's great. And then I'm like, I realize every time I hear one, I go, I really should have got into these guys. Every time. And I'm like, that sounds really good. And then there's movies about them, and everyone knows the Beach Boys. And I always whenever I met any sort of gathering where the Beach Boys come up, I'd go, I don't know anything about the Beach Boys. Just missed that. I obviously wasn't born for it, but at the same time, like as I got to the point where I wanted to be nostalgic, it was more Beatles than Beach Boys. And so I just kind of missed. I know that one.
Honestly, it was Beach Boys and Beatles for me when I first, you know, 12 years old, getting into my first record I ever bought at Jewel was a Beach Boys record. It was some odd, like, cutout record for $1 there or something.
Hmm.
But anyway, Pet Sounds, $50 to $80 for the first pressing in great condition.
And 6-3-0 ends it tonight. Likely played way too much because, of course, it was charity auction for a great cause, but bought a Buck Owens gorgeous acoustic red, white, and blue guitar. Go ahead and tell me it's worth thousands of hundreds of bucks. That's such a text. There's the last seven words in that text were abbreviated.
Right.
I like it. I got the words in, but yeah. Okay. So what would a Buck Owens gorgeous acoustic red and white?
It looks like a few have sold for between $1,600 and $2,000.
All right. Well, there you go.
So
that probably hurts. It stings.
Mm-hmm.
Still not as good as a...
Did he say what he paid for it?
He didn't say.
Okay.
Still not as good as a pair of moderately worn cowboy boots by Bob Hope. That's the winner tonight.
Hard to beat.
Just loved Greg Flam at DuPage Picker. You got any... Where are you going to be this weekend?
I'll be at Rosemont on Sunday.
Yeah. When does Rosemont close up?
Three more weekends. The end of October.
There you go. Greg Flam at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. Another successful swap meet tonight. Good to see you, buddy.
Thanks.
All right, that's going to do it tonight for the download. We're off tomorrow night. Blackhawks. That's right. And then we're back on Friday. Patty Vasquez up next. It's pretty late with Patty Vasquez. Patty, good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Sorry. Are you excited? How are you feeling about a game five? I know you're a big Cubs fan.
I'm not feeling great. I mean, you know what's funny is that the weather seemed to mirror our emotions with today's game.
You're right.
Damp and gross and icky and wet and yeah.
Ugh.
It was all, but I mean, the Nationals had the exact same weather, so
that's
there wasn't.
Right, that's right.
I did have flashes of Steve Garvey hitting a grand slam.
I was thinking. I mean, a lot of times the weather goes east, right? I mean, so wouldn't it's been two bad days of weather? I mean, is it possible DC is going to be crappy too?
Yes.
40% chance of showers tomorrow in the DC area, Justin.
Is. Yeah, there it is.
I checked.
I'm not feeling great, but I mean, like, it's not how I feel. It's how they feel. Although I am a superstitious.
Yeah. What's the superstition?
My superstition this week is that I've every game that I've only I haven't watched the games that we the only game that I watched more of we lost, right? So, which includes today's game and I believe last was it Saturday's game.
Yeah.
I watched more of those games. When I only watch the last half of the inning, we win. So I watched too much of today's game. I apologize to the entire city of Chicago. I will only as soon as
you
I find out
too
where
much. You watch
yeah
too
I
much.
Watch too much. If I'm gonna wait tomorrow until the ninth inning, I'm not gonna be involved at all until the last the bottom of the ninth.
Yeah.
So that's
my
superstition.
You see that the Cleveland Indians lost tonight.
I know the Yankees are moving on.
Yeah,
what against
crazy.
The Astros?
Yankees, Astros. I just love it. I mean, everyone talked about the Indians being the team to beat. Oh, the Indians, and they're out.
Yeah, they were. They were on fire. Now,
all right. What's on the show tonight?
Tonight we have so much going on. It is. We're going to talk about World Stroke Day with Dr. Kathy Tynes and Dr. Jeromey, and we have Wayne Baker Brooks coming in. Our friend Todd Belcore. We've got our friends from the House Theater and Dr. Lawyer. It's so many things.
So many.
My producer's head's exploding. He's like, wait, I think we've overbooked the show every
yeah,
single
you make
moment.
It work. You make it work.
By the way, Pete's hat's bothering me just a little bit, and I think that's why we lost today. I think that his hat's too new. How new is that hat, Pete?
How new is the hat, Pete?
I'm just curious. Your hat, it looks very clean and very new.
How new is that hat? Oh, yeah.
I wear it for playoffs, so.
Oh, so it was in storage. Okay, fair enough.
You only wear that for the playoffs? It's your playoff hat?
Yeah. I mean, don't you have your playoff
what's
hat?
What's hat? No.
Okay.
So we can blame Pete's hat and Patty for the loss tonight.
Yes.
Patty and Pete's
way
hat.
Way to go.
Well
thank
done.
You. We appreciate that. Thank you.
All right, well, have a good show.
Have a great night, Justin and Pete.